This is Five Borough Wrestling Heavyweight Champion, the Man of Steel, Mike Verna, and you're listening to The Solemn Monster Sounds Off.
It's business time, baby.
The Solemn Monster Sounds Off.
My client!
Mama Monster!
Conquered the street!
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat! Delete!
You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
Welcome to episode 499 of the Solemn Monster Sounds Off, here for Sunday, June 11th, 2017. I am the Solemn Monster. Yes, we are 1 week away, if you can believe it, from episode 500. Actually, technically, it's less than a week, because we are doing a live YouTube stream on Saturday night. That's this upcoming Saturday, June 17th. 8 p.m. Eastern Time over on the official Solemn Monster Sounds Off YouTube channel. So please bookmark and subscribe if you have not already done so. It's going to be a lot of fun. First time we're doing the Sound Off live on YouTube. We'll have all the interaction going on with you guys in the chat, in the super chat and all that good stuff. For the people who want to participate, we'll be taking live phone calls. It's going to be a lot of fun, and I hope everybody can join live. If not, you can certainly watch it in the archives. It'll be pushed out to the feed, the audio will, next Sunday. So again, to the people who have been asking me, there will not be two shows next weekend. There will be the one, and then the audio from the live stream will go out as normal on the feed to everyone on Sunday morning. So that is the plan right now. I had a very eventful weekend so far, not in a good way, although looking back on yesterday, thank God I pushed things back to the original date for the live stream, because if you remember, I did that emergency sound off after that awful, horrendous Raw, and that horrendous This Is Your Life segment, and initially I figured everything was going to be bumped up a week, which meant the live show would have been on YouTube last night, but I had quite the day yesterday, and so I'm very thankful that things did not pan out that way, and I have the extra week to prepare for the 500th show. If you were following along with me on Twitter, I was out on Long Island just doing some stuff, and pulling out of a parking space in a parking lot, and all of a sudden, I could not turn my steering wheel to the left. And I was having a hell of a time kind of turning it to the right, but I could at least get the car to turn right, could not turn left. It was making this weird noise. Some poor guy saw me. He kind of felt sympathy on me. He said, "Hey, let me get in there and take a look." The guy could have drove off with the car for all I know, but he's like, "Wow." When somebody says "Wow," you know you have a problem. And it's been very weird. Again, I don't really know a whole hell of a lot about cars and the mechanics of cars and all that kind of stuff. The steering wheel's been sticking for a while. That's how I would describe it, where it just sticks, and then it kind of clicks, but then it turns, and everything's okay. And, I did take it into the mechanic a few weeks ago, and he said, well, he couldn't really diagnose what the problem was, and said, it should be safe, it's fine. You know, and this is a guy I trust, who I've, been going to for many years. And as the tow truck driver said when he finally came, I had to sit there for an hour waiting for AAA. First time in my life I ever had to use my AAA card. Thank God for that. But he said, 5 minutes later I would have been on the highway, and he said that could have been a disaster. So at least you were in a parking lot. So if you can envision this, I'm sitting in this car, I'm waiting for AAA, I'm tracking the tow truck on my phone with the GPS. And I'm basically blocking. I've been able to get the car parallel to all the parked cars in the parking lot. And for an hour, I'm literally, as people are coming out to get their cars, I'm just moving up, I'm moving back. I'm moving up, I'm moving back. Because I couldn't turn left, and I didn't have the room to turn right. So it was quite I guess it's kind of funny looking back on it. It wasn't very funny at the time. But the consensus, I guess we'll find out in a few days. Right now the car is sitting outside until the mechanic gets in tomorrow, but the initial diagnosis was it might have something to do with the what they call the rack and pinion. I have no idea about any of this stuff. I hear rack and pinion, I think of it as a wrestling move. What the hell do I know? What the hell's a rack and pinion? How the hell should I know? I'm sure this is going to end up costing me a lot of money. I'm not very happy about this, but could have been worse. It could have been worse. I could have been trying to make a left turn on an off-ramp or something. So thank God the live show is next Saturday and it was not last night. If you would like to support this podcast, you can certainly do so using Audible. Audible has been a very good sponsor for us, a good partner for the Sound Off now for a number of years, and you people have been killing it lately with the signups. Audibletrial.com/Solomonster. If you use that link, audibletrial.com/Solomonster, go through the signup process. Audible is offering each and every single person listening to this right now a free trial of their service for 1 month. That's 30 days. You get to try it out. If you've never used audiobooks before, this is your chance. You get one free audiobook of your choosing once you sign up. And so even if you cancel the trial within 30 days and you're not billed a dime, you get to keep that book. And there's a lot of good wrestling books on Audible right now, so you'd be foolish not to take advantage of that. The AJ Lee book is up there. The Death of WCW is both funny and depressing all at once. One of the better books I've read, that's up there. Bob Holly's book is up there. I believe Bob Holly's book is up there, but we've had Bob on the show before. His book is one of the best wrestling books I've ever read. One of the more honest reads out there. And I understand that some people do not have access to some books like the AJ Lee book. I guess if you're in the UK, you might not have access to it. I'm not aware of what books are and are not available in certain international markets, so you'll have to check it out for yourself. I apologize if it's not available. But if it's not available now, it should be soon. Just like Justin Roberts' book, which I'm still reading, that should be available on Audible soon as well. So support the podcast, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Every time you sign up and you cash in with our link, we get a little bit of a kickback from that, and so that helps a great deal. So thank you to everybody who's been doing that. And alternatively, you can always make a PayPal donation on thesolomonster.com. On the right-hand side of the page, you will see the PayPal button and link. And I don't know, some people say there isn't a box anymore like there used to be to put a little note for people who want to put a note. If you don't see one, just email me and put, you know, PayPal in the subject line and just let me know whatever it is you want to tell me. You can suggest your own nicknames, by the way. I can't guarantee I'll use them if they're already taken, but I'm not the only one who has to come up with the nicknames here. I'm happy to do so, but you can always make that suggestion on your own. But $10 or more, you can get a wrestling nickname. And I want to say thank you to all the people who donated this week here in advance of episode 500, including the tried and true, of course, John Luce Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Out of Control Cody Thomas, the Florida Freebird Bryant Becerra, Yvonne Bruiser Ballack, Tori All I Do Is Win Johansson, Dwayne Rainmaker Ribling, First Class LT Gilberry, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Brooklyn Bombers, Jamel and Isaiah Walker. Jamel, by the way, wants to wish Isaiah a very happy 19th birthday, so happy birthday to him. Mass Grave, Micah Harshaw, the Prince of Pleasantville, and Nelio Crockett, Kelvin Bearhug Bellow, Stephen Handyman Halistick, Edward Scary Very, Dark Despair, Derek Graziano. You can check out the Sometimes Geek podcast, which covers news from the gaming industry each and every week. You can find it on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, and sometimesgeek.com. Derek also is going to be doing daily episodes to cover all the press conferences from E3 this week. I see a lot of people talking about E3. At first, I see all these tweets, and I'm like, what's going on with EC3? I thought the guy got hurt or he died or something, but it's like, no, E3. So E3 is far more popular than EC3. All due respect to EC3, but that's just the truth. The show-off, Corey Van Dam, the Vigilante, Thomas Murphy, Aim for the Head, Andrew Jorlog, the Warlock, Sean Rue, who says, shout-out to all the guys who donate and keep the show going, shout-out to all the wrestling fans in the world, and most importantly, out to his beautiful bride and soon-to-be wife, Brianna. We have the Aussie Ass Kicker, Matthew O'Sullivan, Good Guy, Gerald Wood, which I guess when he turns heel, we can change that to Bad Guy, Gerald Wood. Just some poor humor there. The Berlin Boy Wonder, Marcus Werner, first-time donator, welcome to the Sound Off family. And Rihanna, she wanted to say, I love you and wish Joshua a very happy birthday. Today, in fact, is his birthday. I hope you guys are enjoying the show, and Joshua is enjoying his big day. I know he is now, after he hears this. That's a very special lady you have there. And one more birthday shout-out here for one of our loyal listeners and donators, Nick from Germany. Happy birthday, buddy. I'm going to attempt this. If I butcher this, I apologize, but I am going to attempt this. Alles gut zum Geburtstag, which I believe in German translates to happy birthday, although I may have just completely botched it and said, you know, put the Frankfurter in my ass or something. I don't know, but what a visual that is, huh? Hopefully I didn't say that. I know there are some people who might enjoy that. I don't count myself as one of them, but to each their own. So anyway, happy birthday to Nick. Boy, where do we go after that, huh? I guess we go here. I was at an independent show on Friday night. I want to give a shout out to FBW, Five Borough Wrestling. You know, Troy Thompson and their whole gang, they put on a great show here in Brooklyn. Every month, every couple of months, they do a great job. I want to also thank Dalvin, one of our listeners, who I got the chance to meet again on Friday night. He went and got us the shout-out you heard at the top of the broadcast there from Mike Verna, who is the reigning FBW champion, and one of the staples of that promotion. I mean, really, I just have praise for the whole crew. They always put on a great show every time I check them out, so I wanted to mention that. Omega and Okada, I haven't seen it. I'm not going to spoil anything. I haven't even read the results yet. I want to wait and see if I can see the match. I'm almost sure it'll be spoiled for me anyway. But it happened earlier this morning at the New Japan Dominion show. The big rematch, the mother of all rematches between Okada and Omega, which, by the way, was given 6 stars by Dave Meltzer for the first one. I don't know how you top 6 stars. So I'm looking forward to seeing how they might try to top it. Those are two very talented guys, two of the best in the world right now. But again, I can't talk about it because I don't want to spoil it for people who haven't seen it, since it didn't air until after 3 a.m. here on the East Coast. And I haven't seen it myself yet, but I am looking forward to it. Extreme Rules was last Sunday, and I did a full 30-plus minute review. It is up on the YouTube channel as a sound-off extra. I want to thank you to the 70,000-plus, I think it's like 71,000 now, who have watched the review on YouTube. The last couple of reviews I've done, and they've been for B-shows, too. It's not like SummerSlam or Royal Rumble. It was for Backlash, with Jinder Mahal winning the championship, and now Extreme Rules. Last couple of reviews have been killing it on YouTube, like 70,000, 71,000. So thank you to everybody who's been checking them out there. My quick thoughts is that I did not see Samoa Joe winning that match. It was a pleasant surprise. I was not disappointed to see it. I thought it would be Balor. Balor was my pick, but I have no issues whatsoever with Samoa Joe going over and getting a championship match. And I thought the match itself was excellent. As it should have been, given the 5 guys who were in that, and they gave them half an hour. So the main event really saved that show from, I thought, mediocrity. I didn't think it was a bad show, but I didn't think up until that point there was really anything special. It was a glorified episode of Monday Night Raw until that main event. And if there's one thing I would say go out of your way to watch, it's that 5-way. The booking of Bayley is something the complete and polar opposite you should go out of your way to avoid. Bayley should have avoided it by just not even showing up that night. I don't know what the hell they were thinking with that championship match. And, you know, when Bayley first came in, one of the things I was hoping is that they would, you know, even if it wasn't exactly every little step, every little thing they did with her in NXT, that they would follow that basic, you know, blueprint. She was always the underdog. Bayley is not meant to win. My issue with Bayley's booking is not that she loses some matches. But the way that they've kind of handled her, I mean, she came in, you know, it wasn't that long ago, right? It was less than a year ago. She came in and she was just like, you know, another woman on the roster, and she was winning matches. And then they put the championship on her in a very weird decision. They decided to do it before WrestleMania instead of, you know, waiting until WrestleMania, which was just very weird. I don't know why the hell they did that. And now all of a sudden it's like, well, this is what you wanted, right? I mean, Bayley is the underdog, so she gets her ass kicked and she loses and she's made to look like a fool. I wouldn't say Bayley was ever really made to look like a fool. She was always someone who you wanted to have sympathy for. I was watching Bayley in that match with Alexa last weekend, and when she wasn't using the kendo stick, and then she got her ass beat in 4 minutes, I was feeling anything but sympathy. I wanted Alexa to take that cane and cane her ass 10 more times for wasting our time. So this weird bipolar booking of Bayley is not doing her any... Just like that This Is Your Life segment a few weeks ago. It's nice that they could joke about it now, and they're self-aware, and they realize how freaking terrible it was. But the damage was done. That didn't do anybody any favors. It didn't do Alexa any favors. It didn't do Bayley any favors at all. It hurt her the most. So, yeah, I hope they get back to basics and they can kind of, you know, figure things out and do the right thing by Bayley and actually get people to care about her and get people to be invested in her and want to see her win the championship. It's kind of a shame that she already did. The story should be in the chase and her very first time finally being able to win the championship, but it's like everybody's got to hold the title at least once, right? They couldn't wait to get that belt on her. So they've really done her no favors. It's not like she's beyond repair or anything like that, but I look at what they've done with her and I just scratch my head. It's like how do you screw up Bayley? She is the easiest character in the world to book, right? This is not complicated. She's not an overly complicated, this is not a cerebral character. You have to really think hard about it. No, it's so difficult. Shades of Grey. She is the ultimate babyface underdog. It's not hard to screw this up, but so far they've managed to find a way to get people not only to not care about Bayley, but to boo her. This was the first time that I heard audible boos for Bayley during a match. It wasn't everybody in the crowd, but it was enough to notice. How the hell do you screw this woman up so badly that you get people to boo her? Well, they managed to find a way. Now they're going to have to find their way out of it. By the way, the final poll results for the pay-per-view, just shy of 3,000 votes. 32% thumbs up, 46% thumbs in the middle, and 22% thumbs down. Exactly why I hate putting that thumbs in the middle option. It just muddies the water so much. I went against my better judgment. I put the thumbs in the middle option. Well, I'm not doing that anymore. But a very thumbs in the middle show, I guess. But I like forcing people to go up or down. If you think there's enough on the show to constitute an up, then give it an up. And if not, then give it a thumbs down. But people did not seem very enamored with this pay-per-view. Jim Ross, interestingly enough, now that we have Samoa Joe headed for Brock Lesnar at Great Balls of Fire. Aren't you excited now? Every single week on TV, we get to hear people mention Great Balls of Fire. Jim Ross on his podcast outright admitted that he has been lobbying to call the Samoa Joe-Brock Lesnar match at the next pay-per-view, which I would love for him to have that chance. I would love to be able to hear Jim Ross for all of the 4.5 minutes that match will probably last, but I do wonder how Michael Cole feels about that. So, would be very interesting to know his true thoughts. Monday Night Raw this past week was live from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. I know it's Wilkes-Barre, but I think it's pronounced Wilkes-Barre. I'm sure people in Wilkes-Barre will read me the riot act if I am wrong. Twitter poll, 2,200 votes, 56% thumbs up, 44% thumbs down. That is one of the first, I think, overall positive results for Raw in many weeks. So that's a plus. And it was well-deserved, if for nothing else, for the Samoa Joe-Paul Heyman segment. Joe came out to cut a promo. Lesnar was not there. He came out and he was talking about he doesn't fear Brock Lesnar. He has no fear for the man. In fact, he respects and he envies the fact that Lesnar can just show up whenever he pleases. He really respects the fact. He wants the same things that Brock Lesnar has. He wants Brock's ability to come and go as he pleases. He wants Paul Heyman to be his advocate, to negotiate his contracts, to go run his errands. And most importantly, he wants Lesnar's Universal Championship. And he said that at Great Balls of Fire, and by the way, I didn't think it was possible for anybody to say that with a straight face and actually make it sound menacing, but I will say Samoa Joe managed to pull it off. He managed to say Great Balls of Fire and still somehow instill fear in people. So that's a credit to how good he is at this. But he says he's going to stare Brock right in the eye and take his title from him. And Paul Heyman was there. He did come out. He was jaw-jacking back and forth with Samoa Joe and talking about, you know, he's really building Joe up. which is exactly what you should be doing, unlike other people in the past, other heels, who made a career out of coming out and actually tearing other people down and making them look like shit, which I always thought was a weird strategy to employ when you're trying to promote a pay-per-view match and get people to care about, you know, you wrestling the other guy. And yes, by the way, I am talking about the dark days of Raw. Which is, by the way, something Ric Flair was great at. Ric Flair was fantastic back in the day. I mean, you know, he can hurl insults at you and talk about, you know, make fun of you and all that. But I don't remember Ric Flair whenever he would go in there with Dusty or Lex or any of those guys. I don't remember him, you know, tearing them down. Like, you don't deserve to be in the ring with me. You're beneath me. You're this, you're that. You know, pointing and laughing at them and all that. Just generally saying and doing things that hit a little too close to home. So Paul Heyman is kind of cut from the same cloth that Ric Flair is in the idea that you build up your opponent, because otherwise, why should they care about the match? And this is a big match. You know, to a lot of people, it's considered a dream match, right? I mean, it's two big tough guys, at least they're portrayed as tough guys on TV, butting heads for the very first time. It's a match we've not seen before, but it's a match people have talked about wanting to see for a very long time. And I thought this whole segment was just brilliant, because it accomplished a couple of different things. First of all, Joe showed he is not afraid of the big bad beast, right? He choked out Paul Heyman. Not too many people get to put their hands on Lesnar's agent. So he choked out Heyman, and he basically said, I want Lesnar. He's not running from him. I want Brock. And the other thing they accomplished is now what they've done is they've set up for angry Brock Lesnar to show up on Raw tomorrow night. First time in 2 months that he'll be making an appearance. He's going to show up. They're teasing that Brock is in no mood. He's going to be on the warpath. He's going to be out to be killing dudes. And that's the Brock Lesnar that I want to see. And as far as Joe, he came back at the end of the show. He had a match with Seth Rollins, and he choked out Seth Rollins. There was no ambiguity about it. There was no cheating. There was no nonsense. There was no disqualifications. There was no slip on a banana peel roll-up. He choked the guy out. He was unconscious. The referee called the match off. And so Samoa Joe comes out of this entire show here looking like a total badass, which is exactly the way that he should look. And, you know, the way they're booking Joe right now, the guy, I think he's really poised to break out, which is not to say that there aren't people who are already cheering for him and rooting for him. But, you know, there's a lot of people in that audience who don't know Samoa Joe the way that a lot of you guys do. The way that, you know, I saw Samoa Joe in Ring of Honor. We saw Samoa Joe for years and years in TNA. We saw Samoa Joe with a friggin' tattoo on his face and a machete. We saw many different incarnations of Samoa Joe. Samoa Joe from NXT, who would constantly yell out William Regal's name. I kind of miss that. But there are people who really don't know. They see Samoa Joe, and he's the guy who came up a few months ago as Triple H's bitch and went after Seth Rollins, and that's all they know about the guy. And so the way they've been booking him as this badass tough guy, I think that he's really poised to break out as a really big deal, whether they intended for this 2 months ago or not. And I know Braun got hurt. That kind of threw everything into disarray. I know we wouldn't be talking about this match right now had Braun not gotten hurt. But I have to say, you know, this is not the match I had pitched for this pay-per-view coming up. I had picked Finn Balor. I just didn't think the time was right for Joe, and I thought it was a little weird because he's a heel, Brock's a heel, which is not to say you can't do heel versus heel. This is a great example of how you can make it work. Although what this may end up doing is turning Joe babyface, which I don't think is what we need right now. But, you know, I look at this and I predicted and pitched for Balor to win because I didn't think it was the right time to do Joe and Lesnar. Not that I didn't want to see it, but I saw that match and I feel the same way I did then when I made that prediction for Balor, and that is this match deserves more than just the one-and-done treatment that's been reported. It's been reported that this is just meant to be a one-and-done type of thing. This is not meant to be a long, drawn-out program or anything like that. There may well just be the one match, and that's it. And if that's the case, I think we all know who's winning and who's not winning this match. And I think that that would be a mistake, looking at the way things are right now. I think to do one and done and just cash Joe off would be a big mistake, because this is the match. Yeah, I want to see Lesnar and Strowman at SummerSlam. I mean, I said it in January, and if that's the match we get at SummerSlam, I'm more than happy to get that match. But I watched this and I thought, you know, they're going with the wrong Samoan named Joe for the match with Brock next year at WrestleMania. That's where this match should have happened. This should have been the WrestleMania match. And depending on how things go, who knows, right? Maybe you call an audible. Maybe it still could be. I doubt it. I mean, they've had their plan. It seems like they've had their big plan set for a long time now. But again, I think the wrong Samoan named Joe is getting that match at WrestleMania next year. And that's my only criticism of it. That a match like this, I think, deserves a bigger stage than a pay-per-view with cock and balls on the pay-per-view poster. But it is what it is. Speaking of Roman Reigns, he wrestled the Eater of Pins, Bray Wyatt, in the opener. Not before Bray first came out to cut his signature spooky promo. He was yammering on about how he was going to save all of us from damnation, and he was hoping that, at Extreme Rules, he would be armed with a sword to slay the beast, but instead they stuck it right in his heart, which means he was a loser, by the way. But he said he's still every bit the god that he has always been. Yes, every bit the goddamn loser he's always been, if that's what he means. Three guesses as to how this match ended. All right, two guesses. Two guesses as to how this... you know what? One guess as to how this match ended. If you said eating a spear and a pin, then congratulations. You have been paying attention. So, it was a good match. It went 20 minutes. I don't know what else to say about it other than it was a long match and it was a good match. That's about it. I mean, I don't know what purpose this served other than, to try to build Roman back up since he didn't get the win the night before. Didn't do Bray any favors. And interesting, they keep using the word possible retirement whenever they talk about The Undertaker on commentary. I really, really hope he's not thinking about wrestling again next year. I just think the way they handled his exit this year... Well, it's a couple of different things. First of all, I think the way they handled his exit this year was the perfect write-off for that character. If it had to be in defeat. Now, I guess maybe they would want to do a redemption deal where he gets to go out a winner. So he comes back and he wins and then he retires. But I think the way he left with all the gear in the ring, taking the jacket off real slow, and they have people crying in the crowd, he puts the gear down, and then the way he sort of descended down to hell in a cloud of smoke and the lights went out. Yeah, I've gotten questions to the podcast over the years. How would you end The Undertaker? What would his final appearance be? And other people have suggested variations of this, where whatever happens, he goes out in a cloud of smoke. And when the smoke clears, he's gone, never to be seen again. It was some variation of that. A lot of people have pitched that, and that's what they did. Basically, he disappeared in a cloud of smoke, lights went out, they hit the gong, and they went off the air. So, it wasn't a great match, but I thought in terms of what they did, it was a very appropriate way, I think, for The Undertaker to go away. So now, you're not only, if he comes back, not only are you ruining that moment, but I don't know that people are going to ever believe that this guy's going to retire. I think people were convinced after this year, like, wow, this is really it. This is really the end. So now if he comes back again, it's like, oh, okay, well, it's like every other wrestler who retires, right? I mean, Undertaker never said he was retiring, but that's kind of the impression they gave you. And if he just keeps coming back, after a while, it kind of loses its value. Like, nobody's ever going to really buy that Undertaker's having a last match. So I don't see any reason for him to come back. I really don't. I don't see him pulling some rabbit out of the hat to this great match, this elusive great match that, like he used to have. There's a lot of Undertaker matches I wanted to see at Mania, like the Sting one and the Cena one, but you know what? That ship has sailed. And, they didn't do it for whatever reason. But I thought the send-off this year was really well done. I would hate to see them go back on that. Kurt Angle consulted with Corey Graves again in the middle of the show about another text message he received. And later on, Mike Rome, backstage reporter, tried to interview Kurt about it, but Kurt left in a hurry. Perhaps Kurt Angle is the next victim of a social media hack. Wouldn't be the first time that Angle's claimed to be hacked. That usually doesn't end very well for him. The saga of Enzo and Cass continued on this show. Cass said that he was never going to leave Enzo's side again, because every time he does, Enzo gets laid out, gets his ass kicked. Or again, he's narcoleptic and he collapses. So he said he's never going to leave his side again, just to make sure that that never happens again. Instead, this week, it was Big Cass who got laid out by a mystery attacker. No doubt himself. Seems almost too obvious now. Maybe they swerve us, but this thing is tailor-made for Big Cass to turn heel in the end. They were supposed to have a match later against Gallows and Anderson, but with Cass hurt, Enzo picked the Big Show. He basically substituted one seven-footer for another. This is like Tommaso Ciampa and Johnny Gargano in NXT. This is exactly why Ciampa turned on Gargano. Everybody was saying, oh, I'm hurt, and everyone's calling for me to be replaced with someone like Oney Lorcan. Just stick another guy in there who kind of looks like me. All of a sudden, I'm replaceable. Screw you. That's exactly what Enzo did here. He just substituted Cass for another seven-footer. So they won the match, and then backstage, Big Cass comes up. He confronts them. It's a Big Show and Enzo celebrate. And Cass suggests that maybe it was Big Show who's been attacking them. And I gotta say, you know, I really like the way that Cass came off in this segment. There was something different. There was something heelish about him. He almost sounded like he dropped his accent a little bit there, too. I don't know if you picked up on that. I will say, though, it is still a little weird for me to hear him with the accent that he uses when I think back to the very first time that I saw him. I saw him at an indie show years ago here in Brooklyn doing the cowboy gimmick. He was Big Bill Young. That was his name. He wore a cowboy hat. He was Big Bill Young. Believe it or not, you can look up, he has a bunch of his matches are up on YouTube. Look up the match with him in Ultimate Security. You'll see, he comes out with the cowboy hat and everything. It's still weird for me to hear him with the Jersey accent or whatever it is that he's trying to do. Bailey was not on this show. They said she was at home recuperating from her injuries. Her injuries? She took a handful of kendo stick shots from a woman who can't be more than 5 feet tall. 5'2", maybe in heels. Injuries. Alexa met with Kurt. She said she wanted her own This Is Your Life segment dedicated to her. Kurt rejected that idea. He said that basically what all of us already knew, which is that the last This Is Your Life segment a few weeks ago was one of, in his words, the worst segments in Raw history, which got a big pop from the crowd. So much for the idea that, oh, it's just the internet fans who love to hate on Raw. This got one of the biggest pops in the entire show. Must be that smarky crowd there in Wilkes-Barre. Or Wilkes-Barre. Again, I don't know how you pronounce it. It's one or the other. It's a very complicated name, for the record. It's spelled B-A-R-R-E. And I know I've looked it up before, and I'm sure I've said it the right way before, but I always manage to screw it up. I think it's Wilkes-Barre. Anyway, I'm going to hear from the people in Wilkes-Barre now. You know that. You just know that. But anyway, the first step is admitting it, so I was happy that they're at least self-aware of the fact that that segment was so friggin' atrocious. Doesn't mean they won't give us another one in the future, but at least they knew this one was bad. He reminded Alexa that she had promised a championship match to Nia Jax if she beat Bayley, which she did, so that set up a championship match for later in the show, which went 2 minutes. I may have to bring back the stopwatch. People have been asking me about that. Mickie James and Dana Brooke came out to watch. Nia was killing Alexa. Alexa rolled out to the floor. She then shoved Mickie and Dana, and they punched her back, and that led to Nia getting DQ'd. So while it was a smart heel move on Alexa's part, fit her character, it made for a bad segment. Nia did kill Dana and Mickie when it was over. She left them laying. I really just don't have any interest in seeing an extended feud between Nia Jax and Alexa Bliss. So I see that Emma is now back on the house shows from her injury. Thank God. Maybe they can incorporate her into this. I wouldn't mind, you know, Emma against Alexa, even though I do like evil Emma. But hey, they're doing heel Joe against heel Brock. So why not do heel Emma against heel Alexa? Miz and Maryse had a big champagne celebration in the ring after recapturing the Intercontinental Championship at Extreme Rules. There was a guy in a bear costume in the ring holding up a sign that said congratulations. The fans chanted you deserve it at Miz, one of the more overused chants in all of wrestling. And Miz, and this is one of the reasons I like The Miz. I've come around big time on The Miz. The Miz, the true heel that he is, had the perfect comeback to this. He said, that chant might mean something to me if you people didn't do it every single time somebody won a championship. Amen to that. Speak truth to power. I will say, though, the one time that chant made me laugh was when Braun Strowman kept killing Roman Reigns over and over again backstage, and instead of having sympathy for the guy, the people chanted, you deserve it at him. That was pure savagery. I don't know where that, what city that happened in, but that city, that's one of my favorite cities. And I'm not hating on Roman. I just thought it was very funny and very entertaining that they would turn on the poor guy that way. Miz thanked Maryse for the bear. Maryse said, I didn't bring the bear. And Miz was frozen in fear, thinking that it was Dean Ambrose who had been looking for Miz. And actually, Dean Ambrose had been kicked out of the building earlier in the show by Kurt Angle. But when Kurt left, Dean snuck back in. He trespassed. So Miz gave the bear a skull-crushing finale. And he ripped the bear's head off to reveal someone who was, in fact, not Dean Ambrose. And at that point, somebody wheeled a giant box down to the ring, and Miz again thought it was Ambrose. He destroyed the box, and Maryse is begging him to stop. Turns out that it was a grandfather clock that she had bought for him. She said it was timeless, just like you. And then she ran off in tears. It's actually more like an old lady shuffle than it was running. She kind of did the granny shuffle to the back. Ambrose finally revealed himself as a cameraman in the ring. He gave Miz dirty deeds, and he drank some of the champagne. I want that bear to come back to be the official Raw mascot. I'm tripping over my words here. I want that bear to be the Raw mascot. I'm tripping over my words because I was going to say I want the bear back on Raw, but then I caught myself there. phrasing, as Sterling Archer would say, phrasing. Everything else was just sort of there. Goldust did another fun promo from the director's chair. R-Truth did his rebuttal later in the show. These guys are just cutting promos on each other back and forth. What's sad about this is that one of these days, these two guys are going to meet in an actual match. And it's either going to end up being a pre-show match that nobody cares about, or it's going to be a match on Raw in the middle of the show that nobody cares about. So maybe they could just keep cutting promos on each other for the next 6 months. I'd be okay with that. Joe and Rollins, I already mentioned, you know, the end of the show, they had a main event. It wasn't really a great match, but they did the right thing by having Joe go over, you know, decisively and cleanly and choking this guy out. The show overall has been better than it's been most weeks. They still have a lot of work to do. Joe and Lesnar is a fresh direction, at least for the next 4 weeks. And promoting Lesnar a week in advance as coming to Raw to kill people, I think is very smart, especially if they, you know, want to try to get their numbers up. Unfortunately, I'm not sure it's going to work this week because they're going to be up against Game 5 of the NBA Finals. So that's probably bad news for Raw. John Cena, who makes his SmackDown Live return on July 4th, so get the trumpets ready, he gave an interview to TheRap.com while promoting the new season of his American Grit reality series. He was asked about the back and forth between him and Miz and the build-up to their match at WrestleMania, and he had some very interesting comments. I wanted to read some of this to you here, and then I'll give my thoughts. This is what he said. He said, I believe that it's a strong survive environment, and accept nothing less. I think people forget my history in WWE sometimes, and the fact that I truly had to earn every inch. There is this overwhelming perception that I am protected and coddled. That could not be further from the truth. Every single opponent that I have, if they don't realize that I give them free range to throw their best punch and just know that I'm going to punch back, I openly let that be known. I just think it's something that goes vastly overlooked. Well, he's not wrong as far as guys taking shots at him in the past. Miz did during their feud recently, right? CM Punk did it all the time, brutally, in brutal fashion. The Rock did it, but I mean, he's The Rock. Kevin Owens did to an extent when they were feuding. He would kind of mock Cena and all of his merch and his t-shirts and all that kind of stuff. And Cena would hit them back. That is true. Although this notion that somehow that means he hasn't been protected for much of his run on top is completely, just absolutely laughable. I don't know anybody who would believe that. He said, I just believe you bring your best to every story, and you bring your best to every fight, and if my skills aren't as good, then it's time to step back. It's just a matter of believing in myself and going out there and speaking from the heart. I believe that sometimes that is something missing in some of the WWE storylines. Being honest and brave enough to put everything out there, on the table. Well, he gets no argument from me about that. I've been saying that for years. Enough with these overscripted, this bad dialogue that we have to deal with on most weeks. Just let these guys be more genuine. Let them be more like themselves. When they come across phony, when they come across rehearsed, it doesn't work. Look what happened to Roman Reigns. Now, that you could point to a lot of different issues why Roman Reigns didn't get over the way that they wanted him to. All right, and by get over, I just mean, you know, this embrace by the fans. Obviously, Roman makes them a lot of money, and he sells them a lot of shirts, and okay, he's not a failure. But what has been a failure is getting the people to care about him the way they've cared about a lot of other baby faces they've pushed over the years. And one of the things that they did to this guy, and they did this to him, is, especially when Vince, remember the stories about Vince for a while took over, like he personally took over writing and scripting Reigns' promos. That's where the whole suffering succotash thing came from and the Jack and the Beanstalk bullshit. That did lasting damage to this guy. That guy is still mocked for that. Now, thankfully, they got away from that. Now he comes out, I'm the big dog, this is my yard, woof woof. At least that's better than suffering succotash. But still, you know, some of these promos, it's like, they sound so wooden and so fake. It doesn't seem real. It doesn't seem like real human dialogue to me. And that's a big part of what's missing, I think, right now from the product. I talk about the formula all the time and the format of the show. We can run the list. It'll take a while. I don't really want to go through all this again. But I agree with him. I wish the same thing. I wish that these guys would be more honest. Of course, what he doesn't point out is that not everybody can just be honest, right? They're there. They hand you something. This is your job. This is what we want you to say. And unless you are John Cena, who I'm sure would have carte blanche to do that if he wants, you can't say, hey, big Cass, how come you're not going out there and being more genuine and being more honest? Because if he did, you know, he's got a much shorter leash than John Cena does. And if you don't think so, then you're fooling yourself. So it's really easy for Cena to be the one to say that, man, I can't understand why all these guys don't go out there like I do, and they just be themselves and be more honest and be more genuine and be more biting in their comments when they're, you know, going after guys. Yeah, gee, I wonder why. I wonder why that is. He's not a dumb person. Cena has to understand this. He's not stupid. He says, I've always done that, and I think the same can be said about multiple storylines with multiple superstars, and it's always with me. This is why I have the reputation of quote-unquote burying younger talent, because I will let them do whatever they want with me, and then after they get done, they're not as motivated. So it's not that I sink their ship, it's that they fail to operate at an elite level. And I'm on to the next person to whom I say, hey, bring your best punch, and I'm going to punch back. And then they don't take that attitude beyond me. Ah, we were doing so well. I was agreeing with a lot of what Cena was saying until we got to this part. It's amazing to me to read that. After they get done with me, they're not as motivated. Right, that must be what it is. He says, it's not that I sink their ship, it's that they fail to operate at an elite level. I'm sure that will go over well with that locker room. Boy, I would love to be a fly on the wall when people are talking about that. You know, the sad thing is, again, I think he made a lot of valid points in the interview, but he just comes off like such a condescending dick with some of these comments. It's like, of course he's protected more than most in that company. Of course there are things he can do that he can get away with that other people can't. You don't think the same was true for Hogan and Austin? I'm not saying it's Cena's fault. You know, a lot of other top guys got the same kind of treatment. Shawn Michaels? My God, I mean, when Shawn Michaels would go out there on TV every week, I know it was a different era, but the things he would do and the things he would say, that would have gotten most people fired. So this guy must live in a bubble if he really believes that. We should call him Bubble Boy from now on. I have a lot of respect for a guy like CM Punk, even if a lot of people listening don't anymore. But I have a lot of respect for CM Punk. He worked with John Cena. He was every bit as elite as Cena was on the microphone, if not more. And he was far from protected in the same way that John Cena was. Punk had to eat a lot of shit and like it. And he was also very lucky to have Paul Heyman early on as an ally. And, of all people, Shawn Michaels, who very early on, kind of in one of these backstage production meetings, spoke up for the guy. So he was very fortunate to have a few kind of guardian angels, if you will, along the way, because he was not well-liked. He was mocked by a lot of people. I mean, look, I interviewed Dave Lagana not too long ago, and Dave Lagana was working on the ECW brand and writing for the ECW brand when CM Punk was first coming up on the ECW brand. And he said it went up to the very top. Vince McMahon himself in these meetings would mock, you know, when Punk would put his hands together in the fist pose and would kind of move his wrists around. Vince would always mock him. He would do the mock pose that Punk used to do. Everybody would talk shit about this guy. It's amazing he got as far as he did and became as big of a star as he did, given all the political BS he had to go through. Okay, so there's a guy who, like I said, was every bit as elite as Cena was when it came to the verbal stuff, but he was not protected. And for him to get up as high on the food chain as he did is very impressive. Even when he was the champion for a year, remember that, or over a year, but when he was the champion that first year from that long reign he had, it was still John Cena headlining every single one of those pay-per-views. Punk worked hard, he got himself over without the machine behind him the way that it was for John Cena. Right? I mean, I would think there's a lot of guys in that company who probably are not very happy reading those comments. And I would say they have every right to be upset. Road Dogg was on Sean Waltman's podcast this week, X-Pac 12360. Road Dogg is, of course, one of the head creative forces on SmackDown right now. And he was asked who from the NXT roster he would like to see on the SmackDown Live roster. And he didn't really have anything earth-shattering to say, nothing that you wouldn't expect him to say. He said, I would love to have Asuka. She's a huge star down in NXT, and I think she could be even bigger. Actually, he said, I think she could be an even huger star. I don't think huger is the right word. But that's okay. So he says, I would love to have her. I would love to have Bobby Roode. I know Bobby is a human being. I've known him for years in TNA. He said, you know, AJ Styles is getting better and better, so I'm really happy that we were able to keep him in the shakeup. And I like the Authors of Pain. They're big, young guys. They're willing to learn, and they're willing to perform, and they're just getting better and better, and their instincts are good. All these things, right? He's talking about all these people. And then he says, it seems like everybody down there is doing well. You know, I was really glad to get Ty Dillinger. He's a great guy. Now, the whole thing I just read, right? Fairly benign statement from Road Dogg. Nothing really surprising in there. But when I first read it, I actually laughed out loud. I had a nice laugh when I got to the Ty Dillinger part. Because when I read that, like, I don't know if it was just the way that it was transcribed and what I read. Maybe he had more to say about Dillinger in the actual interview. I didn't listen to the whole thing. But all I know is he wasn't trying to bury the guy. But it's like, I want Asuka, right? She's a huge star. She'd be even bigger up here. And I love Bobby Roode. I know him from TNA. And AJ Styles. Oh, my God. I'm so happy we got to keep him. And then running the list of all these things he loves about the Authors of Pain. And then at the very end, he just sticks this in there like, and Ty Dillinger, he's a great guy. It's like, I don't know why. I found that amusing. At least he put him over. He did put the guy over. He can't find the guy on TV these days. I don't know where he is, but at least he put him over. SmackDown Live, over 1,500, almost 1,600 of you voted in the poll. 81% thumbs up. My God, 19% thumbs down. I think that's a bit high, personally. Definitely a thumbs up show, but I don't know about 81%. Shinsuke Nakamura pinned Kevin Owens for the third straight time with the Kinshasa, only this time it was their first singles match, at least in a WWE ring. Ring of Honor kind of trolled WWE a little bit. They uploaded their first ever real match together between Nakamura and, I guess, Kevin Steen at the time. They put that match up on their YouTube channel that very same day, only a few hours before SmackDown went on the air. That was a much better match than this one was. I was actually there live for that match. That was at the Hammerstein. That was the same night that Kevin Steen announced that he was leaving Ring of Honor. I was not overly impressed by the match they had here on SmackDown. It was okay. I think these guys could do much better. It was a TV match. You know, Nakamura won with the knee strike, as he should have. He should not be losing this early. Baron Corbin laid out Nakamura after the match with the End of Days. And those are three of the six participants in the Money in the Bank ladder match next Sunday. The other three, being Dolph Ziggler, Sami Zayn, and AJ Styles. I am going to do Money in the Bank predictions next weekend on episode 500. And so when we do the live phone calls, you guys can call in and we could talk about Money in the Bank on Saturday night. So that'll be fun. They had all the women out there with Shane McMahon for the unveiling of the new women's Money in the Bank briefcase, which thankfully is not pink with flowers and Hello Kitty stickers all over it, which would have been something that they totally would have done 10 years ago. It's actually white with gold trim. I think it looks better than the blue one. I'd rather have that one than the one they use for the guys. Naomi came out. She was very sad that she could not be part of the Money in the Bank match. Aw, well, you know, vacate the title. You could be in the match. You know, I don't know. If I was champion, I'd be pretty content not to have to wrestle four other people with ladders thrown at my head. Maybe it's just me. We then had the debut of Lana, who wore a blue evening gown to the ring. Lana has, in fact, arrived. She still has the Russian accent. Yeah, they broke her away from Rusev, and she's already dropped it, the accent, on Total Divas. You would think they would have her drop it here, too, but nope, still has it. Even Kofi, my God, Kofi Kingston didn't last this long with that Jamaican accent. Just one day, he just didn't have it anymore. Triple H even called him out on it. She asked Shane to put her in the Money in the Bank match, and all the other women laughed at her. Naomi laughed at her. Naomi asked her, "What did you, or who did you ever beat?" she said. "Who did you ever beat?" So Naomi here, low-key, shooting on Jinder Mahal. Lana said, "I can beat you." And then they got up in each other's face until Shane told Lana to understand that here on SmackDown Live, you have to earn things. And then Lana freaked out and she stormed off. Remember this, okay? I want you to remember what I just said. Shane McMahon telling her that you have to earn your opportunities here on this show. Keep that point in mind. We had a 6-woman tag team match, Natty, Carmella, and Tamina, against Naomi, Charlotte, and Becky Lynch. Lana made her way back out during this match. She distracted Naomi. When the referee turned his attention to something else, Lana grabbed Naomi's leg on the apron. She swept it out from underneath her. Tamina then nailed Naomi with a Samoan super kick for the win. So they threw Tamina a bone here, kind of the way they did Dolph Ziggler against AJ last week, just to make you think, you know, one of them might actually win Money in the Bank. You know, I actually give Tamina more of a chance to win Money in the Bank than I do Dolph Ziggler, but I still don't think it's going to be either one of them. I think Carmella is my early pick for the women's match. Backstage later, Naomi demanded a match with Lana at Money in the Bank, and she said, "I'll even put my women's title on the line." And Shane tried to talk her out of it, but she really wanted that match, and so Shane ended up granting her wish. So, going back to the point I made before, the commissioner of this show agreed to grant a championship match to the woman he earlier said did not deserve one. So, if I'm Charlotte, if I'm Becky, if I'm Natty and Carmella or Tamina, I'd be pissed right now. Speaking of Ziggler, he had a rematch with AJ Styles, and what do you know? They did the old 50-50 deal with AJ getting his win back from last week. This was not as good as their first match. They had a cool sequence, though, at the end where Ziggler kicked out of a pin attempt, and AJ transitioned him into a Styles clash. You got to see it for yourself, but it was pretty cool the way that how seamless it seemed to be. And he won. He actually won with the Styles clash. About time he won with that move. He hasn't won with that move in a very long time. Jinder Mahal wrestled Mojo Rawley in a non-title match. Shane McMahon had promised Mojo that if he could win this match, he would be inserted into the Money in the Bank ladder match. Now, Mojo does have a win over Jinder Mahal since Jinder came to SmackDown, in fact. We're not talking 6 months ago. It was not that long ago that Mojo Rawley, of all people, pinned Jinder Mahal clean in the middle of the ring on the show. So he should have a championship match, should he not? Right? Doesn't that make sense? He shouldn't have to earn it. He should already get a championship match. But yet he has to earn one. But Lana, who has yet to have a singles match, not only on SmackDown, but anywhere on the main roster in WWE, this is her very first ever singles match, to my knowledge, is getting a championship match next Sunday. The land of opportunity, but not the land of common sense. Mojo knocked one of the Singh brothers off the apron, but Jinder raked the eyes. He threw Mojo shoulder first into the ring post and Cobra Clutch Slam for the win. I don't think either one of these guys looked all that good in this match. Jinder cut a promo on Blandy Orton when it was over. He said Orton was sick. All of us fans were sick. He is the antidote. He said, "I am the medicine that you people need." You know, a lot of antibiotics give you the shits. I'm just saying. He spoke to his people in his native Punjabi and then went to climb the ropes. He slipped, and everybody laughed at him. Interesting note from this week's Observer that I noticed. Not too long ago, before he got an offer, I guess, to come back to WWE, Jinder was apparently looking to get out of the wrestling business, and he was going to open up his own Subway sandwich shop. And look at him now. I just had Subway yesterday. It's very delicious. I already mentioned Nakamura's win over Owens in the main event, Corbin laying him out with the End of Days at the end of the show. The reason Corbin was out there was because he beat up Sami Zayn backstage. See, the old thing used to be beat up John Cena. The new thing now is beat up Sami Zayn, which is what Baron Corbin seems to do every single week. And so he beat him up again. In the middle of an interview, he beat him up, took his spot at the announce desk. The weekly Baron Corbin beatdown of Sami Zayn is becoming a SmackDown tradition. Sami just can't seem to catch a break. A bone break, maybe. But that's about it.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
Pro Wrestling Sheet had some more information on WWE's UK series on the network. Still no start date, but the plan, apparently, is to shoot television over there every 6 weeks, with live events running every other week. Pete Dunne, Tyler Bate, Wolfgang, Trent Seven, and Mark Andrews have all signed updated contracts. I just saw footage from the, that UK Download Festival, that music festival. NXT has been there the last couple of years. I saw there was video on, it might have been WWE's YouTube channel. I guess Pete Dunne attacked Mark Andrews. Mark Andrews is in a band, I think, and they were performing, and he was going to be wrestling Pete Dunne on that tour, and I guess Pete Dunne attacked him on stage. And then Pete Dunne hopped down off stage, and Mark Andrews did a big dive off the stage onto him. It was actually pretty cool what they did there. I wish they would show, hopefully they'll show stuff like that on the TV show. But they've all signed updated contracts, TV tapings every 6 weeks, and house shows twice a month with the UK talent, I assume at smaller venues over there. So that is the plan as of right now. Also, some more information on the Mae Young Classic from PW Insider. It appears WWE will tape the first and second rounds of the tournament at Full Sail University July 13th and 14th. And they will then release the entire first round of the tournament in their on-demand library, kind of the way Netflix does, at the very end of August, so that people can binge-watch all the episodes at once. So if you are a fan of that format of binging on stuff all at once, you are in luck. It's going to be a little weird for me to review, though, because if everything is released all at once, it kind of forces, I think, as like somebody who reviews these shows, it kind of forces me to watch everything all at once, too. Whether or not I have time for that, I don't know. So I'm going to have to figure out how I'll cover that. It's a lot easier if the show just airs once a week, right? You watch it once a week like everybody else, and you talk about it, and you wait for the next episode. This is a little bit different. So that's how they're going to be releasing it. And I guess, you know, sadly, the other aspect of this as well is that it gives plenty of time for people to, I guess, get the results spoiled, right? Spoilers are going to leak out. And, I guess it was the same thing for the Cruiserweight Classic. So I guess it's not that big of a difference. But they're going to do the same thing with the second round, releasing them all at once about a week later. And then the finals would be held live on the network on Tuesday, September 12th. And unless they add an event at Full Sail, it looks like the finals are going to be held at the SmackDown tapings, which are in Las Vegas that day. And that worries me, because the worst thing they could do, I think, is air that thing after SmackDown the way they do 205 Live. In the same arena, after sitting through an entire episode of SmackDown, if they just don't do 205 Live that week and they put the women, these women that a lot of people don't even know, after SmackDown's already gone off the air, that's a disaster. That's an absolute disaster. Part of what made the Cruiserweight Classic so fun was the atmosphere at Full Sail. It was in that very intimate setting. I mean, they did the live finals for that too, but they did it at Full Sail. That's how this should be done. And I hope I really hope they don't do that. And I'm also not even sure why it has to be on a Tuesday night, because I guess it's going to bump 205 Live unless they do it maybe before SmackDown, which if you're going to do it, you may as well do it before, not after. But I don't know why they don't just do it after NXT on a Wednesday at 9 o'clock or something. To me, that would seem to make more sense. Heavy Machinery opened NXT this week against Lars Sullivan, the former Dylan Miley, and Victor Andrews. They are continuing the gimmick where Sullivan destroys people, and then for some reason, he decides that now would be a good time to tag out to my partner. And then inevitably, the partner gets killed, and Sullivan goes nuts on him after the match. Same thing happened here with Victor Johnson getting squashed after Lars Sullivan was kicking ass for a while. And he was literally squashed, by the way, by Otis from Heavy Machinery. So Heavy Machinery wins. They leave. Sullivan is just seething on the apron. He's about to explode. He gets in the ring, and he just loses his shit. He loses his shite. Gave him a choke slam, gave him a backbreaker over his shoulder. Referees wouldn't get in the ring. They're imploring from the outside of the ring for him to just drop the guy. Please let the guy go. And finally he did. So now we wait and see. I didn't see anything on their YouTube channel, but what they did last time was they put a little bonus video up on YouTube showing Dylan Miley finding his partner backstage. He was all apologetic. He couldn't believe what he had done. You know, it's the whole Incredible Hulk thing where, oh my God, I lost myself. What happened? I'm so sorry. We'll see if they do that again. I didn't see anything on their channel. But, you know, he definitely has a unique look. We need to see more of him, I think, in the ring to get a real sense of what this guy's got. But he came into the business totally cold, I think. No experience whatsoever. He just, I think, showed up one day. So he's been like a project for them. I mean, he really is a product of that performance center. And they've been hiding him now for a couple of years. They've been breaking this guy in. They're building him from the ground up. He could be one of those guys that we point to in a few years and say, hey, he is a product of the performance center. They bring in so many indie guys. Relatively small amount of guys I think we can really point to and say that the PC made them. He could end up being one of those guys, right? Like, he's a legit star that they actually made. I hope so. I hope that we can say that in 2 or 3 years. I hope so. Roderick Strong came out for a promo. He said the last year for him has been a roller coaster. He came to NXT. He has a beautiful fiance and a handsome baby boy. He said life has never been better, but it's missing something, and that's the NXT Championship. That brought out Bobby Roode for the highlight of the night, which also happens to be one of the nicknames that Chris Jericho was never able to get over. He got the word it over, right? He got a list over, he got a scarf over, but not highlight of the night. That didn't really stick. So Roode comes out on stage with what looked like a piece of toilet paper. He's patting his eyes like he was just crying in the back. He was feigning tears over Roddy's very emotional speech. Very just heart-wrenching. He talked about how great things have been for Roddy lately, how he's winning matches, finally, which got a nice reaction from the crowd. He said he has a moderately attractive fiance and a relatively normal son. I fucking died when he said that. I'm like looking at people in the Facebook group who are like, oh, what happened to NXT, man? NXT's not what it used to be. I saw the show this week. It was terrible. Bobby Roode's promo was so paint by numbers. Look, I'll be the first to admit, NXT is in a rebuilding phase. They are not what they used to be, but I hope they get back there. To say anything negative about Bobby Roode's promo, are you out of your mind? This was great. I thought this was fantastic. I was laughing my ass off during this thing. And what a fantastic heel this man is. And what a terrible husband and father Roddy is. If somebody walked out and started shit-talking my family, I wouldn't just stand there in the ring mouthing silent words. I'd jump out of that ring and beat the snot out of him. But nope, Roddy just stood there, he took it. Roode called him a good hand. He said he might even take a selfie with him one day so that he can show his son what a real champion looks like. He said, you don't just come into my NXT and get a title shot, you have to earn it. Yeah, tell that to all the women on SmackDown, now that Lana is getting a title shot. But I thought Bobby Roode was awesome here. Crazy Mary Dobson. I know some of you know that name. She is now Sarah Logan in NXT. And she's doing a gimmick where she is a country girl. She's just a good old southern gal who used to wrestle goats, we were told. She got a decent amount of offense in against Peyton Royce, but Peyton hit her with a knee to the face, hit her with a perfect plex, and got the win. They showed highlights, or lowlights, I guess, depending on how you look at it, of Andrade Cien Almas losing to Cesar Bonanni the week before and just casually blowing off the loss to go party. Well, we got footage. What we did not see was this footage from outside of Full Sail last week. As Andrade was leaving, he was arm-in-arm with a couple of women. And up walked Thea Trinidad, the former Rosita from TNA. She walked up to him. She was none too pleased with him. She ended up slapping him in the face and walking off. So it appears that they're going to be doing something with the two of them. Ryan Satin had broken the news this week on his website that Thea had signed a deal with WWE. She'd done some work for them before. I guess The Rock pitched for her to play... is it Paige? Is she playing? No, she's not playing Paige. AJ Lee, I think, is who she's playing in that movie about Paige and her family. So she's done some stuff for them before. Obviously, she's with Austin Aries, so she's kind of, she's been around. She's been involved. Now they just made it official, I guess. They put a ring on it. And so she has signed a contract with WWE. She is officially in. And even if she's doing something with Almas, I would think that we would end up seeing her in the May Classic, in the May Young Classic. Hideo Itami against Oney Lorcan. They aired a clip of Itami answering a question about rumors that he may be going back to Japan. That was one of the big rumors this week. He dispelled those rumors. He denied them, said that he has more to accomplish here in America. These two guys beat the living daylights out of each other, and I loved it. And, you know, Oney Lorcan is a weird... he is a weird guy, but Oney Lorcan is a weird one. Because you know he's only there to be a good hand, right? As Bobby Roode called Roderick Strong earlier in the show. I mean, that's the very definition of how they use this guy. But his shit gets over more than most once that bell rings. I mean, he's in there, he's slapping Itami in the face. These open-hand slaps. He's chopping him. Gave him a pair of uppercuts that rocked him right off his feet. Then it was Itami's turn. And he ended up hitting the GTS. He did not go for the pin. Instead, he picked Lorcan up. He delivered a second go-to-sleep. He was still quite angry, so he picked him up again, gave him a third one. By that point, Cassius Ohno had seen enough. He could take no more. He came to the ring. He got all up in Itami's face, asked him, "What the hell are you doing?" Itami shoved him. Ohno responded in kind, shoved him back. And then Hideo rolled out of the ring, and he left. And the referee, I guess, rang the bell and threw the match away. I'm not sure why he didn't disqualify Oney Lorcan, since Ohno shoved Itami, but whatever. Next week, we are getting a Drew McIntyre match, and Asuka will defend her women's championship in an elimination match against Nikki Cross and Ruby Riott. Asuka's unbeaten streak, by the way, now stands at right around 180 wins without a single pinfall or submission loss since joining NXT 2 years ago. That means more wins than Goldberg. And Goldberg's number was inflated. So that's pretty impressive. I mean, it's all worked, obviously. It's impressive. I mean, impressive is a relative term. You know what's impressive? When I say things like that are impressive, it's impressive that they've had the patience to not beat her after 180 matches. So that's really what's overly impressive about this. It's the way they booked her, and I guarantee you that that would not have happened had she gone right to the main roster. So worked out well for her to come to NXT first. I always figured it would be Ember Moon. She'd be the one to beat her, but then Ember got hurt. I'm liking my idea more and more. I think it'll be a bigger deal if the winner of the Mae Young Classic gets a shot at Asuka. And I still say it should be Hojo. Hojo would be my pick. But maybe they do that match at the November Takeover show in Houston. You know, the finals are not going to be until September. I didn't know that. I thought this thing was going to be all wrapped up before SummerSlam, so I figured you could take the winner of the tournament and match them up with Asuka in Brooklyn, but tournament's not going to be over by then. The finals aren't until the middle of September. So you can have whoever it's going to be win that tournament. And then I guess the next takeover is the one in November and you can do the match there. But, you know, whenever they choose to do it, I do think that that's the way they should go with it. I'd be curious what you guys think. I want to get some of your feedback on this too. Would you pull the trigger on Ember Moon, who it looks like is going to be matched up with Asuka at Takeover in August? So would you pull the trigger on Ember and do the title change there? Would you give it to the winner of the women's tournament later this year? Or would you not beat Asuka at all and let her go to the main roster undefeated and maybe wrestle Charlotte at WrestleMania? You know, there's a lot of different ways you could go with this. I'd be curious what other people think. Main event was No Way Jose. This was his first singles match, I think, since WrestleMania weekend. Against Killian Dane of Sanity. It was more just a showcase for Killian. He won with the Ulster Plantation, the One-Winged Angel, which, of course, is Kenny Omega's big move. Again, I have not yet watched the match with Okada. I'm looking forward to it. I wonder, my whole thing, one of the things I loved about the first match he had with Okada was that they teased it. But as great as that match was, he never hit the One-Winged Angel. He never did. And he didn't win. And I thought that was so great because you knew at some point he was going to get the championship. It was just a matter of when. And when he did, it probably would have been with that move. So I'm as curious as anybody to go watch that match. I'm avoiding all the spoilers for it. But that is Killian Dane's move. He calls it the Ulster Plantation. He got the win. Pretty ho-hum stuff. And that was NXT. I did not have a chance, just so you know, to watch Impact this week. I know it was their first show, I believe, from India. I think the next several weeks of shows are in India, so I'll check it out next week, but I just didn't have time. So this week, I have nothing nice to say about Impact. In fact, I have nothing at all to say about Impact. I do have something to say about Ring of Honor, though. PW Insider reports that Dalton Castle was signed to a new ROH deal sometime in the last few days. So despite whatever interest WWE may have had in him, he is going nowhere. And that's good news for Ring of Honor. I'm stunned, and I said it on the show a long, long time ago when I came to the realization that this guy's been around Ring of Honor for a while now. He's one of the most popular guys there. And at the time, he hadn't even gotten a championship match, let alone a chance to run with the belt. And I was just stunned by that. I'm still stunned by the fact that this guy has not held the championship or been wrestling for the ROH title. He's really, really good. The people love him. He's got a great act. And I just don't understand it. Now, part of the reason might have been because he wasn't locked up long term. Now that he is, let's see what happens. Let's see if they finally propel him into that main event, scene. Because I always thought he should have been the one to take it from Jay Lethal or take it from Adam Cole, and it just never happened. But there were a lot of rumors that he might jump to WWE, so, if that's the case, I can understand Ring of Honor's hesitation here. But now that he's signed, hopefully he gets that chance. Lucha Underground! This was episode 2 here from the, I guess not the new season, but the second half of season 3. They came back last week with that All Night Long match with Johnny Mundo and the Mac that I loved. It's a great match this week. It was Johnny Mundo and the Mac Part 2. And it was for the Lucha Underground Championship after last week's tie. But as Dario Cueto said, there are no ties in Lucha Underground. He made this a Falls Count Anywhere match. More crazy stuff from these two guys. They brawl through the crowd. Too much stuff to even recap here. But Ricky Mandel showed up yet again to help Johnny Mundo. He's like, Mundo Mini here is Ricky Mandel. They brawl through the crowd, as I said. And so as this is all going on, Mundo says to Ricky, "Go get the chainsaw." And I'm like, "Ooh, where's this going?" But instead he grabbed a garbage can instead. I'm like, those are not quite the same thing. So that was disappointing. I wanted a chainsaw. Sexy Star came out. She attacked Ricky Mandel. PJ Black came out from under the ring with a kendo stick. He whacked the Mac in the head with that thing. My God, I've never seen a kendo stick shot to the head like this before. I don't know if it was an added sound effect after the fact or what, but my God, that thing sounded terrible. And terrible in I guess, the best possible way. But a shot like that to the head making that kind of noise can't be good for you. I don't care how gimmick that thing is. By the way, on PJ Black, I heard Tommy Dreamer on the Edge and Christian podcast. I hear they have a very funny podcast. I don't have a chance to listen to it every week, but I had read something that Dreamer had said reportedly about PJ Black. So I went to the episode. I wanted to listen to it myself just to see if it was accurate. And it was. And I guess he has a recurring segment on there called Tales from the Indies. Because Dreamer, he runs his House of Hardcore promotion, but he also still does a lot of indie stuff. So, and he's, been very good friends with Edge and Christian for a very long time. He had cameos on their WWE Network show, which I'm sure he'll probably have more in season 2. But anyway, he was on the podcast, and he said he was supposed to have PJ Black on one of his upcoming House of Hardcore shows, but he hurt himself again. He already broke both of his ankles last year in a base jumping accident. Bad enough to break one ankle, he broke both of them at the same time. I think only in the last few weeks he even got the stitches out. Now, according to Dreamer, he hurt himself base jumping again, and this time he broke his leg, he broke his hand, and he lost a finger. He didn't say which finger, but he's got 9 digits now instead of 10. He did that base jumping off a building. Good luck getting health insurance. He must have a bitch of a time. This guy's out of his mind. So we won't be seeing him for a while, I don't think. Thankfully, these episodes were taped many, many months ago. But anyway, he set 2 tables up outside the ring. He ended up on the apron with the Mac. And the Mac gave him a stunner. And when he did, PJ popped up. He fell backwards. And he fell right through both tables. Taya got involved a little bit later on. She distracted the Mac. Johnny Mundo hit a sunset flip powerbomb to the Mac off the apron, and there was a pile of chairs outside the ring. He powerbombed this guy so hard, his head whiplashed right off the chairs. Ugh, it was sickening. Sickening. So, you know, I'm not a fan of all these repeated shots to the head with the kendo stick, and now that's, you know, that can't be good for anybody. But I thought the match was a lot of fun. Johnny Mundo got the pin. He is still the Lucha Underground champion. Then came the unveiling of Dario Cueto's latest concept, the Cueto Cup, which is a small trophy. I was actually kind of disappointed. Like, he built this thing up, and then Melissa Santos comes out holding this thing, and it's like a little trophy. It's like something you can go buy in the store. It's got little tassels on the end of it. I'm like, really? That's it? I mean, look, my expectations are set very high. You got to remember, last season, Dario was walking around with this friggin' amulet. He gave Brian Cage the Nintendo Power Glove to walk around with, which gives him these mystical, magical powers. So here comes Melissa Santos with this little dinky trophy here. It's a little disappointing, I got to say. So she comes out with the trophy, and basically what's going to happen here is that there's going to be a tournament with 32 luchadors. They will have a chance to fight, with the winner getting a Lucha Underground Championship match at Ultima Lucha 3. They'll get the trophy, they'll get the title shot. Vampiro had the line of the night here during this segment. He goes, "I'd like to fill that cup up with Jägermeister and shoot it." I feel like if I ever went out partying with Vampiro, I feel like I'd never be the same again. I feel like it would be fun, but I would just be scarred for life, and somehow I'd end up with, like, hepatitis or something. Something crazy like that. Dario also said that on that night, when they crown the first ever Cueto Cup winner, there will be a Lucha Underground title match, so a double main event. And the title match will pit Johnny Mundo against not his brother Matanza, because he said Matanza looked very weak the last time we saw him when Rey Mysterio... Remember Rey Mysterio knocked him? He, like, fell through the roof of one of the offices. He said, so it won't be my brother, it'll be Rey Mysterio getting the championship match against Johnny Mundo. Cobra Moon's Reptile Tribe beat Drago, Aerostar, and Phoenix to win the Trios Tag Team titles after Drago turned on his partners and aligned himself with the Reptile dudes, which makes sense, given that he's a friggin' dragon. I've seen this only one other time that I can remember, where one guy ditches his own team to join the opposing team in mid-match, and both loses and wins the titles in the same match, which is exactly what happened here. The only other example of that I can think of is when Cody Rhodes turned on Bob Holly and he joined up with Ted DiBiase Jr. So Cobra Moon put a collar around Drago's neck with a chain attached to it to lead him around like her pet, so we have new champions. Then we got a fantastic segment. Johnny Mundo had just come out of the shower and Ricky Mandel is there waiting for him. All of a sudden, Taya walks in. She says, "I got some bad news." You're going to have to defend your Lucha Underground title against Rey Mysterio at Ultima Lucha. And Mundo turns to Ricky. He says, Ricky, go warm up the car. I need to get to my dojo. So Ricky runs out. He goes to warm up the car. And once Ricky leaves, Mundo turns to Taya and he goes, I didn't want the kid to see me nervous. Ray Ray is no joke. If I'm going to take him to Slam Town, I'm going to have to train harder than I ever have trained in my entire life. And he goes to leave, and Taya says, wait, aren't you going to put any pants on? Because Mundo's only wearing a towel. And he thinks about that, you know, he stops and he thinks about this, and he just goes, no time for pants. And he walks off. That also happens to be Randy Orton's philosophy in life. No time for pants. It's my philosophy, too. You see, you don't know if I'm wearing pants right now or not, do you? You can't see. I could be wearing nothing right now, for all you know. I apologize for the visual, by the way. Main event was Prince Puma against Mil Muertes in a Boyle Heights street fight. They brawled into Dario's office at one point. He was all concerned they were going to, you know, destroy all of his stuff. He told him, get out of here. He was clutching his cup, by the way, the Cueto cup. I thought that was funny. Puma whacked Mil Muertes in the head with a wrench. 10 seconds later, he was already no-selling it. Puma hit a Van Terminator in the ring, but he did a spin in midair on his way down. So he found a way to outdo RVD on RVD's own move. Puma hit a 630 senton in the corner. He landed right on top of Muertes. Normally, he'll land, like, with his head, but he fell right on top of this guy, just like Jeff Hardy. We see the same thing now with Jeff Hardy whenever he hits the Swanton Bomb. He used to, like, barely connect with the guy. Now, he just, his whole full body weight just lands on the guy. And that's exactly what happened here. So Katrina can sense that this is not going well here. She gets in the ring with her stone that she carries around with her, and she nails Puma in the head with the stone, knocks him out. So she gets out of the ring. Mil Muertes is trying to recover. Puma's trying to recover. Vampiro puts the headset down. He goes over and he hands Puma a brick. Now remember, Vampiro is looking to mentor Prince Puma, even though Rey Mysterio has warned him, stay away from Vampiro, he's bad, stay away. Vamp gives him the brick. Puma looks at it. He's always been the ultimate quintessential babyface, right? But he's looking at this brick and he's staring at it, and here comes Mil Muertes and he says, ah, the hell with it. And he shatters the brick over Mil's head and he scores the pin, and Vampiro is pleased. So another fun show. I liked the show better the week before, just because I thought that match was fantastic. But this was a fun show. Still no Pentagon yet. No Famous B. We haven't seen any Famous B yet either, but the season is still young. I'm sure a lot more good stuff is yet to come.
Solomonster, it is I, Noah Mark, with an audio mailbag question. I'm from Miami, Florida, home of The Rock. And it just so happens 3 years ago, The Rock surprised Rusev and the Barclays Center on Monday Night Raw. It was a great promo. And I'm just trying to think of some of the top five Raw moments in maybe the last 5 years where there was a big crowd reaction, a big to-do. And maybe you can help me because I'm starting to forget, or maybe I'm seeing or sensing there's a lack of that. So I turn to you, Solomonster, oh great wise one. Thank you.
He's just trying to suck up to get on the 500th episode next week. But yes, it is the mailbag time, by the way. If you have questions, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from, as Noah did there in that clip. I think you'll be hearing his voice next week on the show. But to your question, Rock and Rusev. Rock and Rusev was a surprise. I think you're always going to get a big reaction to a surprise. You know, I'll give you some examples. Shane McMahon. Right? Look what happened when he came back. I don't remember what city. It might have been Detroit, but he got a monster reaction when he came back. And that shocked a lot of people. That was a raw moment right there when Shane McMahon came back that night. So that's got to be top five in the last, if we're talking last 5 years, easily top five in the last 5 years. Dolph Ziggler, cashing in Money in the Bank. That was within the last 5 years. Cashing in right after WrestleMania. Winning the World Heavyweight Championship, the building shook when that happened. That's how big of a reaction that was. So I'd put that in the top five. Daniel Bryan, one of my favorite Raw moments from the last 5 years, easily. Daniel Bryan leaving the Wyatt family and beating up Bray inside the cage. That's an all-time great Raw moment right there. That's an all-time great Raw crowd moment right there. The way those people were going nuts. Gives me goosebumps whenever I go back and I watch that thing. The Shield, confronting the Wyatt family for the very first time. I remember them being on opposing sides of the ring, and slowly they would inch toward each other, and then finally they were on one apron, and then the Shield was across on the other apron, and there was this like palpable buzz in the crowd. It was awesome. It was the first time we had really seen these two teams confront each other like that. I don't even know if they ever touched that night, but that was an amazing segment. That was a great crowd reaction. That was a memorable segment, so I'd put that on the list. Yeah, 2 years ago, I just tweeted a link to this video yesterday. I was making a point about how they should let the cruiserweights mix it up with the top guys every now and then. Seth Rollins had a championship defense. He was the WWE champion, and he was defending the title on Raw. I know, a rare WWE title match on TV. It's we don't see many of those now. Maybe that's part of the problem. Maybe they should at least do that every now and then. But he was defending against Neville. This was back in 2015. And it was a fun match. I thought it was a really, really good match, but it had one of the best near falls that I've ever seen in that match, where he hit the Red Arrow, and that move has been so well protected over the years that you can honestly buy into the fact that Neville was going to win that match. I would dare say most people watching, or most people in the building that night, based on the way they reacted, thought that Neville actually had a chance to become the world champion. He hit the Red Arrow. He hooked the leg for the cover, but he overextended himself. So he hooked the leg with such force that Seth Rollins, he pulled him so much so up off the mat that Rollins' foot touched the rope. And people didn't see it. People didn't realize it. And so the referee held his count at the very last second when he saw that, and people were going nuts. I love that near fall. That near fall made the entire match. What I also remember about that match is when Rollins finally got the win, he hit the pedigree. Neville took the pedigree the way that people should take the pedigree. He didn't put his knees down, you know, like the way Triple H does it now. When he hooks the arms, he lets go on the way down. So it's like the move looks terrible now whenever he does it. But this was like an old school pedigree where he hooked the arms and Neville took this great bump for it. That match was so great. That near fall was so great. People were losing their minds over it. It's one of those things I look back on and it convinces me that things can be that way. It's not like they're incapable of giving us compelling television and compelling matches like that that people care about. People badly wanted to see Neville win that night. They cared. They wanted to see him win. And when they didn't, they were very upset, but they were reacting to this thing like it was a big deal. That could have been a freaking pay-per-view main event, the way those people were going out of their minds. So I'd throw that on the list, too. Again, I say this. I know Raw is not what it used to be, but there have been a decent number of crazy crowd moments in the last 5 years. You know, it's not all bad. Now, maybe by percentage, given that they do one show every single week, so you multiply 52 shows a year, right? Multiply that by 5 years. Maybe the number's not that big when you really try to put together a list of all these moments. But you can definitely find moments where the crowds had some kind of a gigantic reaction to something and just made it that much more fun. Got a question here from Alex from Houston. Deluxeman from YouTube. I've noticed SmackDown's show quality has dipped since the shakeup. The structure feels oddly similar to Raw, and it does not feel like the same SmackDown that we have gotten since the draft last year. In your opinion, how long do you think it'll take SmackDown to get back to the quality it had when the draft first took place? And what would you change to help speed up the process? You know, I think one of the things that they just need to keep doing is just keep cycling in new talent. I know it's an hour shorter than Raw, but Raw does have the stronger roster, at least in terms of names and like star power, even if those stars don't always show up. But I think that SmackDown's strength is that they've got a lot of talented guys who can go. They've got a lot of fresh faces. They brought up some people from NXT. I think if they keep cycling in some new talent, you know, a guy like Ty Dillinger is not going to be a game changer, but he should at least be on TV. Again, I said this earlier. I don't know what happened to him. Maybe he's hurt. He's kind of dropped off the face of the earth. But, you know, there's been rumors about, like, Mike Bennett and Maria maybe going right to SmackDown. I think it would help to have some new faces. I think that John Cena coming back is actually going to help. Maybe not Jinder Mahal, but it will help the show overall. I think Rusev, he should be back any week now. I'm curious to see, you know, what they do with him, because whatever plans they had, obviously, they scrapped. They just got the New Day back, so that's a boost to the tag team division. American Alpha, what the hell happened to those guys? Right? I had very high hopes. I still have high hopes. I would get them back in the tag team picture as soon as possible. So I think those things are going to help SmackDown. I think that this Jinder Mahal, Randy Orton stuff is not working. And so that needs to end soon. This match at Money in the Bank has to be it, whether they take the title off him or not. And I wouldn't. I'd keep the title on Jinder for now. And Orton's going to have to just move on and do something else. And maybe he's better off as a heel. Maybe, you know, we can do something with him and AJ when AJ's done with Kevin Owens. I'm kind of intrigued also by the idea of like a Randy Orton Nakamura match. I don't know whether that would be really, really good or really, really dull. That's an interesting one for me. I hadn't really thought about it until just now, but that could be something that we're looking at down the road. But SmackDown, it just has to keep, I think, doing what they've been doing in terms of like the fashion files. I enjoy that. I think those segments are entertaining. I think for the most part, it's goofy, but I think that's comedy that's more funny than it's not funny. It's more hit than miss. I think SmackDown's doing fine with some of that stuff. You know, they'll usually end up with like a really good main event at the end of the show. The show's usually paced pretty well. I'm not really digging all the stuff with the women, that they do each week. I think it's a little clunky sometimes, but, you know, I don't really have as much of an issue, I think, as some people do with SmackDown. It's not exactly what it was 6 months ago, but I think, you know, if they just kind of figure out, okay, these are the people that we want to focus on. These are the people that we want to push. Jinder's our guy, so be it. Jinder's the champion. Wouldn't be my first choice, but whatever. It's someone different. Baron Corbin, he kind of stalled. And I don't know if that's because he was going to get the spot that Jinder Mahal was going to get originally. Maybe Baron Corbin would be the champion right now. He seemed to be on that path. If anything, I think the feud with Sami Zayn kind of stalled him a little bit. But I'm a Corbin fan. I enjoy Corbin. I enjoy his, you know, his trash talking and all that kind of stuff. I think he's a guy for them to focus on. I think AJ should always be the focus in some form or fashion. AJ should be the focus. They've got AJ. They've got Nakamura. I mean, they've got some big names on that roster. Like I said, Cena's coming back. I think that'll help. And they just have to keep doing what they're doing. But like I said, cycle in new talent. Let's get some of these guys back like Cena and Rusev and see where they fit in the pecking order. American Alpha, get them back on TV. The pieces are all there. You don't have to make radical changes to SmackDown. I'm just very hesitant to sit here and say, well, you know, SmackDown needs all these wholesale changes. Raw needs wholesale changes. SmackDown just needs a few tweaks here and there and they'll be fine. You can have one week where SmackDown's just this blowaway show and the next week it's like, eh. But that's going to happen, right? I trust that SmackDown is going to be consistently at least good. That's a trust that Raw has to earn back from me. I no longer have that. I have not had that trust in Raw in a very long time. Raw could go have the next 2 weeks as great shows, and I still would not trust that they would come back the third week and have a good show. So they have to really build that trust back up with their audience. SmackDown doesn't have that same problem. I wouldn't, you know, worry too much just yet about SmackDown. I think overall they're still doing pretty good. Matthew from Aurora, Illinois. With the addition of the women's Money in the Bank, I was thinking about the possibility of Money in the Bank cash-in at a house show. The announcers love to state that the Money in the Bank can be cashed in anytime, anywhere. They also love to tell us that anything can happen at live events, but I've never heard of a title changing hands there. Well, I don't know how long you've been watching wrestling for, but title changes have taken place many, many, many times at house shows over the years. Diesel won the WWF title at a house show. Anyway, he says, to me, it seems like having a Money in the Bank cash in at a house show would be an excellent way to make good on both of those points. Do you see WWE doing something like that with the women's Money in the Bank, where they might have been more reluctant to do that with the men, and do you think it would be a good idea? I don't. Title changes are fine. I'm a big proponent of doing a title change every now and then at a live event. There's so many more live events than there are TV events. It's kind of unbelievable. Like, literally unbelievable, if we're thinking about this in real terms, that a championship does not change hands at a live event more often than it does. So I'm a big advocate for doing that and making those shows feel more, you know, important in that respect. You could change the IC title or the US title, the cruiserweight title. There's no reason that, and I know cruiserweights are on Raw, but there's no reason you can't have the cruiserweight title change hands on a house show and then switch it back maybe on TV. I'm not saying they should do that now. I like the run that Neville is on. But you can do stuff like that. It's fine. It's okay. So with titles, that's fine. I have no problem with that. Money in the Bank, though, it's a special thing. Money in the Bank is like the Royal Rumble, right? You get one briefcase each year. One for the men, one for the women. And that's it. That's all you have all year long. And with so many hours of television, I think it would be foolish to do a cash-in at a show that isn't televised. Now, obviously, they would show highlights of it on TV, but that's not the same thing. So change the cruiserweight, change the IC, change the US, change the tag team. That's fine. Maybe the UK title. Perfectly fine. Every now and then, nothing wrong with that. A cash-in, though, to me, it's a waste of a briefcase. It's a waste of a briefcase. I would not do that. Luke from Arizona, there's been reports that with her new gimmick, Lana is going to be a replacement for Eva Marie. While she is gorgeous, and she is, she also has very little experience in the ring. Is WWE setting her up for failure by Lana being a substitute Eva Marie? I don't know where that's coming from, that she's a substitute anything other than maybe Emma. I've heard that the character that Lana's portraying is maybe what Emelina was supposed to be. That's the closest thing to her being a substitute anything that I've heard. This Eva Marie thing is, I think, nonsense. I don't think that's what they're trying to do here at all. Now, I know Lana's been training for a while now. I've not seen her wrestle. We don't know how good or bad she is. She has no business getting a championship match, obviously, but I'm taking a wait-and-see approach. I want to see how she looks in an actual match. Maybe she shocks people. Maybe she has two left feet. Let's see how she does. Bruce from London, England. A quick question about Jinder Mahal. What do you think about the fact that he was only involved in a mid-card position for his first match following his victory over Randy Orton? Do you think it's indicative of how WWE rates him as a star? I know it's a little different as Brock does not work many Raws, but do you think if somebody like Roman Reigns was champion, he would be involved in a match like with someone like Mojo Rawley, as Jinder was last week on SmackDown? I think you're reading too much into it. I think it actually made sense because Mojo had a win over Jinder. That's the only reason the match even happened. Jinder had to avenge that win. How can you leave that hanging out there like that? You're not going to feud them in a pay-per-view main event. God help us all if the main event of the SmackDown pay-per-view in July was Mojo frickin' Rawley against Jinder Mahal. So you have this lingering here that, hey, Mojo has a win over this guy a few months ago. So they did the match to blow it off and give Jinder a win. I have no issue with it. I mean, and we've seen other examples in the past of the world champion having matches with mid-card guys. This is not the first time that's happened. Triple H once defended his championship against friggin' Taka Michinoku on Raw. And actually, that was a hell of a match. This was not a hell of a match. This was actually a bad match. But as far as does it show how they show Jinder, the guy's the champion. The guy should be thanking his lucky stars. I mean, the guy was brought in to be a job guy. And now he's the WWE champion. What's he got to be so upset about? I think he's actually very happy with the position he's in right now. I think he's very lucky to be in the position he's in. Not to say that he hasn't put the work in. But there were a lot of things working against the idea that Jinder Mahal would ever amount to anything in this company. Just the way he's been booked for so long. He should be very, very happy with the position he's in and enjoy it for as long as it lasts, because it could go for a year, he could go to WrestleMania as the champion, or he could drop it next Sunday to Randy Orton. If I'm him, I'm just enjoying the ride, because you never know when it's going to end. But I don't think him wrestling Mojo Rawley on TV is indicative of anything other than they had a loose end to tie up on TV. That's it. Jason from the Bronx on this week's Something to Wrestle With podcast while discussing why Steve Austin's heel turn was unsuccessful. One of the reasons Bruce Pritchard gave was Triple H not turning babyface around the same time. I've heard you mention this before and the idea that Triple H knew better than to go up against Austin and so instead he lobbied to team with him. My question is, who could you have seen at that time, besides Triple H, as the babyface to Austin's heel? Well, The Rock. But the problem is The Rock went off to film a movie. That's why they were in, you know, they were put in a big lurch because Rock was leaving to go film, it might have been The Mummy Returns or something, whatever it was. So he was gone. It should have been The Rock. But he left. And so that's why it was even more of a problem that Triple H didn't take over in the babyface role. Because they had a role that had to be filled. He would have taken that spot. They badly needed somebody in that spot. And so instead, and they teased that Triple H was going to go babyface, but instead they did the swerve and he hit Rock with the sledgehammer. And so we got the two-man power trip instead. When my understanding has always been the original idea was Triple H to go babyface. He didn't want to. And so he sort of lobbied, hey, let me team up with the most popular guy in the company. Let me get some of that rub. And it worked. He's a smart guy, that Triple H. You go back and watch TV on some of those weeks when him and Austin would come out, Triple H was positioned as the top guy. Triple H was doing most of the talking. He came across like an even bigger star than he was for being aligned with Austin. And I have no doubt in my mind that he knew that going in. That was the whole idea. Problem is, they didn't have a strong babyface. So they feuded with Kane and The Undertaker for a couple of months. And then when that ran dry, they had to go with Jericho and Benoit. They had to try to make those guys, main event level or perceived to be main event level. I mean, in the ring, those guys were main event level guys, but they had not really been positioned that way up to that point. So that was the problem that you ran into. I don't know exactly what Pritchard said on his podcast. I didn't hear it, but that's what I had always heard. And, you know, I think he was still working for the company at that time, so he would know. And I'm happy, if anything, to hear him confirm it, because I've said that on the show before. You know, it should have been Triple H. Why not? It's pretty obvious why not. Here's the other thing. Triple H had to know, right? He had to know that Austin had just won the championship. And if he was going to be the first person to feud with Steve Austin, he was not winning that championship. He was going to have to lose to Steve Austin, and maybe they would trade some wins back, but I don't think they would have changed the title. So Triple H, part of it, I'm sure, was he looked at this, and he's smart. He says, look, I'm not going to be the guy who, you know, the first in line to put this guy over. I'd rather be with him than against him. And then after 2 or 3 months, I'm moved down the card in favor of someone else. Now, we'll never know what would have happened because he tore his quad. Again, my understanding was the idea was that there would be a split, maybe in June, between Triple H and Austin, and maybe at that point, Triple H would then challenge Austin. But it was something that they would build up to. But a couple of things happened. Triple H tore his quad, and they did the invasion with WCW, which Triple H missed that entire thing. Who knows what Triple H's role might have been had he not gotten hurt. But he was apparently smart enough to know that he should not be the first person out of the gate losing to Steve Austin. Let's see here. Isaac from London, Ontario. I saw that Vince McMahon might be on a future episode of Table for Three. Who would you want to see as Vince's other two dinner guests? Ted Turner and Paul Heyman. I see a lot of people saying Eric Bischoff and Paul Heyman. Too cliche. And we've seen Bischoff already on this show. I want Ted Turner and Vince McMahon together at dinner. And throw Paul Heyman in there because Heyman fits into that whole thing anyway because he was very instrumental in that whole time period and the influence of ECW and the Attitude Era and all that. And Heyman also is another one who never got along with Vince, so I think him and Ted Turner sitting at the same table with Vince, you got to make that an hour-long episode too. I got to say, these 20-minute Table for Threes are killing me because I love the show to death, but it's too short. It's too short. They got to order an appetizer, let them order dinner, let them get dessert. Stretch it out for an hour. If they do get Vince on that show, whoever he's there with, they got to stretch it out. I don't want to see an 18-minute episode of Table for Three with Vince. We got to get more than that. We got to see Vince order a big T-bone, right? Because Vince ain't going to order a salad. He ain't going to order any of that crap, right? He's going to order a steak. But no, Ted Turner and Paul Heyman would be my pick. I did think about Vince, Shawn, and Brett. I mean, I know that whole thing has played out, but I think that would have also been an interesting dinner table conversation. But then I remembered, like, I saw Shawn on Table for Three, like, a couple of months ago with Kevin Nash and AJ Styles, and he was barely coherent. He was awful on that show. So I'm like, you know what? Let's do Ted Turner and Paul Heyman. That would be my choice. Dylan in Louisiana. Do you think some of the talents in the Cruiserweight division are being limited or pigeonholed because they are under the purple banner? I see how great Neville has become in his heel role. Plus the following that Jack Gallagher has gained, and I then see The Miz as the Intercontinental Champion for the zillionth time with no real roster of competitors for that title. Do you think WWE should fold the Cruiserweight division and put guys like Aries, Rich Swann, Jack Gallagher, Neville, TJP, and others in contention for the Intercontinental and U.S. titles? I don't think they should get rid of the Cruiserweight title, but I am all in favor of axing 205 Live. I don't think they need that show. They have a UK show coming to the network soon. As far as I'm concerned, that UK show can take the place of 205 Live. You know what Raw could use? More Cruiserweight title matches. Not building to a different show that barely anybody watches. You have 3 hours of Raw every single week. So I would say one way to make the show more exciting would be to build up Cruiserweight title matches for Neville every few weeks instead of just saving them for 205 Live. And, you know, he defends them on the pay-per-views and that's fine. But when was the last time we saw one on Raw? Well, they have this other show, so why have them on Raw? Raw is essentially I mean, look, every single episode of WWE television is a commercial for something. Every Raw and every SmackDown is a commercial for a pay-per-view. That's really what they are. So Raw is a commercial for 205 Live. But because of that, nothing eventful with these guys ever really happens on Raw. And that's part of why a lot of people don't really react. They don't really care about these segments. They kind of gloss over them, or they get up and they go buy popcorn or something. So you've got all this TV time on Mondays, you got all these talented guys who can fly around and do all this stuff, and where are the Cruiserweight title matches? Let's make this show more exciting here. Why doesn't Neville put some sort of open challenge out there? You know, they did the open challenge gimmick with Cena in the U.S. title, and it was great. Neville, I almost think, like, and maybe it wouldn't be every week, maybe every other week or something, but there's so many guys out there that you can do an open challenge with Cruiserweight level guys and, like, never run out of guys. I'm convinced of this. There's no reason not to do stuff like that. But to answer your question, do they get pigeonholed in that division? Of course they do. We knew this would happen. Of course. You're affixing a label to someone. You are a cruiserweight. You're not a heavyweight. You're not like everybody else. You're down here. Everybody else is up here. When was the last time you saw a Cruiserweight match headline Raw? You never have, right? And you never will. Because they're not positioned on the same level. So right away, you're automatically pigeonholed in that division as being a few steps below everybody else. Which is what annoys me, that a guy like Austin Aries, you know, has kind of ended up that way. And I'm hoping that he can transition out of that into mixing it up with guys like Joe and Rollins and people like that. And Miz. I think Aries could be a good contender for Miz's Intercontinental title, because I tell you this much. I don't know if you agree with me or not, but I love the Miz as in this role he's in right now. But this whole Miz Dean Ambrose thing has got to go. I feel like between SmackDown and then both of them ending up on Raw, this is the feud that will never end. I've seen this 1,000 times, and I am so done with it. Let's get some new blood in there for Miz to defend that title against. There are some guys in this division, not even just Aries, who I think would match up really well with Miz. They could have some fun matches. But again, my opinion. That's part of what I think is missing from that show, though. But I look at this and I say to myself, why are some of these guys, like an Aries or a Swan, why are they segregated from the rest of the roster? Who is there a law that says they have to be, like, you have the cruiserweight division, but you have to be segregated from everybody else? Only recently have they started to, like, blend a little bit. Sasha Banks teamed up with Rich Swann, and that's kind of a step in the right direction, but I don't know that that's really indicative of any kind of a change. But why can't Seth Rollins pick, Austin Aries, or pick, I'm using TJP just as an example, but pick somebody, or pick Jack Gallagher as a tag team partner one night when he needs a partner? Why can't Mustafa Ali take up Miz on a championship match one night? And we've seen none of that. So obviously they don't allow it. And that needs to change. It's time to shake up these boundaries that they seem to have created on this show, because God knows it could use a little shaking up right now. Joe and Lesnar, great way to do that. But what about the rest of the roster? What about them? What about Raven? St. Clair from Los Angeles, do you think Scott Hall's son Cody will make it to NXT? And if so, how successful do you think he will be? I have no idea how successful he'll be. Whether or not he makes it to NXT is up to him. I mean, he's had some issues, I guess. He was with New Japan, and then he got hurt. He got a very, very serious neck injury. And he's back now, but I don't think he's with New Japan. I think he's with Noah, or with some other promotion. Which made me very curious. Why would he not just go back to New Japan? So I wonder if something happened there. I don't know. You know, I don't know how his attitude is. Does he have a good attitude or not? It depends on a lot of different factors. He's a big guy. I mean, he's got to be every bit of 6'8". He's a tall guy. He seems to be very athletic. I haven't seen enough of him to know how good he is at this point. But look, Scott Hall's his father, and Triple H runs NXT. So I think it's only a matter of time before they give the kid a look. Phil from London, UK. I caught up with last week's Lucha Underground and the All Night Long match. I noticed that nearly every single strike in this 45-minute match, no matter how it was dealt with a hand or a foot, forearm or a head, was accompanied by a thigh slap. It made me think how overused it is in wrestling today. My non-wrestling fan girlfriend saw me watching a Jack Gallagher match and saw Jack's headbutt. She couldn't figure out what the move was. She said it looked like he just slapped his thigh and the guy fell over. She didn't even see the headbutt, only the thigh slap. I'm so used to seeing it that I don't realize how ridiculous it must look to non-fans. Do you think the thigh slap is overused, and should guys cut back on it? Oh yeah, it's overused. This is what happens in wrestling. People start to use something, and then everybody starts to use it. Right? We didn't always have guys doing suicide dives on Raw and SmackDown. I don't know where it started, that it became something everybody did every single week. But Seth Rollins was doing it. The Usos were doing double dives in every single match. Luke Harper was doing dives. And so you go from dives, thigh slaps, there's like certain types of kicks. It's like there are things that everybody does now, and those things become less special. So it makes for a great sound effect. I know why they do it, but they've always done that in Lucha Underground. There are times I've complained about it. It sounds like a gunshot going off, but they do it so often that it starts to sound phony. But we see it in WWE and other promotions all the time, because now there's so many kicks. We see a lot of kicks and knee strikes and stuff like that. I don't know if it's the MMA influence or what it is, but now everybody does it. There is not a single WWE match where you don't see somebody do like an enziguri to the back of the head, and you hear the thigh slap or whatever they slap. Like, there are certain things like that that we see in every single match. So is it overused? Oh yeah, of course it is. It sounds cool as hell, but maybe there's a different way to do it that's not as noticeable. I don't know. I mean, they're the pros. I'm sure they could figure something out. I could see that. I never really thought about that from a non-fan perspective, but I could see how ridiculous that must look. But you know what, though? That's similar to when a guy does kicks in the corner or punches. What do? They stomp their feet. That's been done for decades. I don't see people complaining about that. The thigh slap, I guess, maybe it's more noticeable. I don't know, but in a way, it's kind of no different, I guess, than the old foot stomp that people do in every single match. And you probably don't even notice it because you're used to it by now, but I would imagine it would be kind of funny to sit with a non-fan and see if they pick up on stuff like that. Why is that guy stomping his foot? every time he throws a punch. Why is that guy slapping his ass every time he throws a kick? So yeah, I could see where that would be distracting if you're not a fan and you don't know what the hell they're doing. Reese from South Carolina, besides his matches with Shawn Michaels and Triple H, are there any other Undertaker matches at WrestleMania that had a great storyline behind them? I would say the first match with Kane has got to be number one. Or number two, maybe behind the stuff with Shawn, which I'm a big fan of his matches with Shawn. But I'd say the first match with Kane at WrestleMania 14, that story was built up over many, many months. And it goes back, I think, to June, the year before, where Paul Bearer first revealed that, you know, he had a brother that was alive. That's how far back it went. That was a nearly year-long build-up to that match. I'm trying to think of another one that had a great storyline, a great Undertaker WrestleMania match that had a great storyline other than Shawn and Triple H. I mean, Edge cashed in Money in the Bank on Undertaker the year before their WrestleMania match, and then Undertaker beat him for the championship the following year. But I don't remember that being all... I don't remember the build to that being all that great. I almost feel like they each went on to do separate things and then kind of revisited their feud, so I wouldn't call that a great storyline heading into their match. I think that might be the only other one, other than the Shawn stuff and maybe the Triple H stuff. It would be the match with Kane, the first one. I don't know that there's been any other Undertaker match that I would say has had this great, wonderful build to WrestleMania. I actually thought the build for the CM Punk match was really stupid. You know, him pouring ashes all over him and all that. The whole impetus for them even having a match that year, that was the creative guy. Remember that? They brought some new guy into head creative, and his great idea was, okay, here's how we're going to figure out who wrestles The Undertaker this year. We're going to have a four-way match on TV, and whoever wins the match gets to wrestle The Undertaker. What a shit way of trying to figure out a new challenger for The Undertaker at WrestleMania. So that guy was fired months later. He didn't last very long. So everything about that build-up I was not a fan of. The match was good, but, you know, the stuff with Brock, I mean, you can't even really look at any of the Undertaker's matches in the last five years, because the booking and how they've handled the build to a lot of these Undertaker WrestleMania matches in the last few years has been so freaking lazy. I mean, that was my biggest complaint going into the match with Roman Reigns this year. There was no story there. It was so lazy. But when I think back to the early Undertaker years, Giant Gonzalez and King Kong Bundy, and oh my God, I mean, it's even worse. So really, yeah, it's slim pickings if you're looking for some great storyline build to an Undertaker match at WrestleMania. Dave from Liverpool, UK. I'm watching the Attitude Era Raws and pay-per-views on the network and just watched SummerSlam 99. I remember watching it at the time and always thinking that Mankind won the championship by mistake in the main event, especially since Triple H ended up winning it back from him the next night. I always felt Jesse Ventura made an error and they just sort of went with it. What are your thoughts? I know I've answered this before. There was no error, there was no mistake. Depending on who you believe, either Austin did not want to lose to Triple H and he lost to Foley instead, which is why Foley got added to the match in the first place, just so that he could then drop it to Triple H on Raw. Or it wasn't a case of Austin not wanting to put over Triple H, but it was just a very simple case of them not wanting to have the governor, which is what Jesse was at the time. He was the governor of the state, not wanting him to count the fall for Triple H and raising the hand of a heel. I tend to think it probably had more to do with that than anything else. Because Austin ended up doing a singles match with Triple H about 2 months later, and he lost to him. I mean, there was some interference and all that, but yeah, it's not like he outright refused to do the job for Triple H. So I tend to think it had more to do just with them not wanting Jesse to, you know, to end the show with the governor, their big guest, having to crown Triple H as the champion. Let's see. We got two questions about championship belts. Brandon from Cyberville, Tennessee. What was the deal with the extra large belt that WWF made for Andre? Was he meant to get an actual run, or was it just a prop? It was a beautiful design, and much better than the pre-Winged Eagle belt that Hogan had at the time. It was just a prop. They actually donated that belt to Planet Hollywood back in the 90s. I remember that because I saw the photos of that ceremony or whatever it was at Planet Hollywood. There's actually a picture in the WWF magazine. Sometime in the early 90s, he was holding it up. It was on a white strap. I remember that. And they donated it. And I think there was a version of that belt that was also made with a black strap. But and that might have been the one that I think Bobby Heenan was parading around on TV. But the one they donated had a white strap. And it's funny, you know, I went fishing around online to find out what happened to it, because I was curious. And apparently the Planet Hollywood in Florida, where they did the donation, went out of business. And the belief, nobody can confirm this, but the belief is that that belt is locked up in storage somewhere in a warehouse. Which is a damn shame, because it really is a nice belt, and it would have a lot of value now, right? I mean, considering how far back it goes, and it was for Andre, and Andre's obviously since passed away, and this big fondness for like wrestling memorabilia and old stuff now. And I don't know why WWF or WWE has not tried to buy it back. It puzzles me. I would think they'd be able to find out if they really cared enough. And Triple H has been buying up old wrestling memorabilia for years now. So clearly they do care about this stuff, or at least he does. Maybe Vince doesn't give a shit. But Triple H has been buying robes and old belts from guys because one day they're going to have a physical Hall of Fame somewhere and they want to have that stuff to put on display, even now when they do fan access. All those artifacts that you see are going to end up in a physical Hall of Fame one day. You don't think they'd love to have that Andre belt from 87? So I don't maybe not. Apparently not, because they're not looking for it. So I don't know why they don't just find it and buy it, and they can, you know, they can put it on display with everything else. I think that belt belongs in the Hall of Fame just like everything else does. Jay from the UK, you recently said that you associate the current design of the Intercontinental Championship with The Miz. My question is, out of the following titles, who do you associate them with the most? Well, first of all, I associate the Intercontinental title of today, all due respect to The Miz, that white title, I associate that with Shawn Michaels. He was the first person that I can remember to have a white Intercontinental title. I know the Ultimate Warrior had the IC title, but I don't think it was ever white. I think he had a white WWF title. But like the Warrior had black, he had blue, he had yellow. I think those are the colors he had for the IC. So Shawn in like 93 or 95 or whatever it was, he was the first person I can remember to have that white IC title, so I associate him with that. The other titles that Jay listed here are the spinner belt. I mean, come on. Obviously, we know who we associate that with. The Winged Eagle belt, which is my favorite, as you know, of all the titles. For me, it's a tie between Hulk Hogan and Bret Hart. So when I think of that belt, those are the two people I think of. The Attitude Era belt. I assume you mean the Big Eagle. That's Steve Austin. Let's see here. The World Heavyweight Championship. Big Gold. That will forever be Ric Flair. I don't care what incarnation it is, what company it is. You know, when Flair had it, when Flair left, and then Rick Rude had it, when WWF had their own version of it, that belt will always be the Ric Flair belt. He'll always be the first person I associate with that. Let's see here. The United States Championship. Well, if we're talking about the WCW version, I don't know that I associate that with anybody in particular. I mean, now the WWE version of the belt, same thing. I mean, there really is no one person. I mean, maybe Benoit? If I had to pick someone, it might be Chris Benoit. And finally here, the egg-shaped Intercontinental title. Ah, yes, the Attitude Era IC belt. Not really a fan of that one, but when I think of it, I think of The Rock, since he was the first person to hold it. So there you go. Those are who I associate with each of those titles. John from California, Loose Cannon, writing in with a buy or sell for us. Buy or sell on pre-Hell in a Cell Mankind from 1996 to 1998 as the more dark and sinister character, or post-Hell in a Cell Mankind from 1998 to 2000 as more of a comedy character with Mr. Sacco. Well, he was way more successful as the post-Hell in a Cell character, which is really kind of, I don't know if sad is the right word for it. I say sad only because you look at Mick Foley's career and the hell and the abuse that he put his body through. He just had a hip replacement not too long ago. All of the physical abuse and the concussions and everything he felt he had to put himself through to make a name for himself and become a big star and become a drawing card. And yet it was that period, I would argue it was that period, you know, with The Rock and Mr. Sacco and all that, where he was arguably at his most popular at any point in his career. And what he was doing, he was still taking physical abuse, but he was getting over doing comedy stuff, wearing a sock puppet on his hand, which is relatively safe stuff. So it makes you wonder, but you know, at the same time, had he not done all the crazy stuff, he probably wouldn't have even been in that position. So I guess you're kind of caught in this situation where I guess he kind of had to do it that way, but I'm sure he regrets it now, taking the kind of abuse that he did. So as popular as he was, and as much money I'm sure as he made them, and all that stuff, my favorite, what I'm buying on, is the pre-Hell in a Cell Mankind from 96 to 98. I really like that character. And I thought it was actually a 96, more than 97 and 98. So we're talking about a relatively small period here. But from the moment he debuted, right up until the end of the year, and like the stuff he did, the Buried Alive match with The Undertaker, all the matches he had that year with The Undertaker were pretty good. King of the Ring match, which gets forgotten a lot because it wasn't Hell in a Cell. That was a really good match. I watched it not too long ago. I really liked their Boiler Room Brawl at SummerSlam. I thought the Buried Alive match also was pretty brutal stuff for WWF at that time. And then sandwiched in between all the Undertaker matches and him being the first person to ever really give the Undertaker a run for his money that way, you have this unbelievable match with Shawn Michaels, which showed a different side of Mankind, of that character, where this guy could go. This guy could go in there and have a great friggin' wrestling match and not just brawl with people. That's one of the best championship matches in the history of that company. And I think Foley has even said that that was him at his peak. I mean, physically, in terms of the kind of match he had, I think that was the lowest. Up until recently, he's lost a lot of weight recently, but in his active career, that was the lightest he had ever been, the best shape he had ever been in. So I'm a big fan of that version of Mankind, the sinister version of the character, the mandible claw, when it was actually a menacing move and not a joke. So I'm going to buy on that, and I'm going to sell on the post Hell in a Cell Mankind. And finally, our boy Deadpool tweeted me, pointing out that the final episode of The Sopranos aired 10 years ago this week, and he actually linked me to the final scene on YouTube, wanted to get my thoughts on it. My thought on it is Tony's dead. In real life he's dead, but I mean, the character. I think he got whacked in that scene. People are going to be debating that scene until the day they die. David Chase, and he knows it. He knows that there probably is no answer. It's like, you fill in the blanks on what you want it to be. One of those dumb things. I think he got whacked. I think they foreshadowed it. There was a reason why they even replayed that clip from an earlier episode of him and Bobby sitting in the boat, when Bobby just goes, you know, when you get shot, I bet you don't even hear it. I bet you don't even hear the shot. There's a reason why they would show that again. I think he definitely got it. And it's funny, in the video he linked me to from the final scene from the last episode, the top comment on the video is so great. Top comment is, my theory. Now there's, if you remember that scene, Tony's sitting in a booth at a restaurant and they're playing the Journey song, you know, Don't Stop Believing. And he's waiting for his family to show up and he's looking around and he's seeing all the different people sitting in the restaurant. And he's kind of on the run at this point. I say on the run, I mean, he's got to have eyes in the back of his head because people are out to get him. So there's a guy in a jacket, I think in this scene, he's wearing a, like a members only jacket, So that's what he's referring to in this comment when he says this. But the comment here is, my theory is that the members only guy tried to shoot Tony, but he hit the cameraman instead. And I'm like, you know, I had never thought of that before, but I bet that's exactly what happened. The guy fired the shot, he hit the cameraman, and that's why the screen went blank. Now it all makes sense. So I laughed when I saw that. There's a lot of very funny comments, actually, if you browse on any of those videos that have the final scene. Everybody's got an opinion on what happened there. The one thing I think we can all agree on, if you watch the show as I did, is that it's one of the best shows of all time. It may be the best show of all time, but again, I'm a big fan of The Shield. I just am a really big fan of that. I haven't seen The Wire. Everyone always throws that in my face. Well, you haven't seen The Wire. I haven't seen The Wire. So I put a little asterisk next to what I'm saying here. But The Shield, Breaking Bad, and The Sopranos. If I had to make a top three, you've never seen any of those shows before, or some but not all, do yourself a favor and make sure you watch them. You want to see good television, spend your Monday nights watching one of those three shows instead of Raw. I guarantee you'll enjoy yourself more. So we're going to end the mailbag there. Try to get as many questions in as I could. You can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I will be taking, or planning anyway, on taking mailbag questions. I may not do as many of them, but I am going to do mailbag questions on the show next week. And so if you would like to try to possibly get your question included on episode 500 on YouTube, then you might want to email me your questions. I make no guarantees. But next weekend is, of course, episode 500 of The Sound Off. I can't believe it. It's finally here. I can still remember 300 and 400, and now here we are for 500, and God, I feel old. But here we are, and it is next Saturday night, June 17th, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Please do not ask me, as many people have, well, what time is that in my time zone? There's a little thing called Google. You can type in current time. Wherever you are in the world, this is very simple. You can type in current time, New York, and see for yourself what time it is in New York, and then you can figure out where you are, how many hours ahead you are. So you may be 5 hours ahead, you may be 6 hours ahead, you may be 3 hours ahead. You don't need me. I don't have the answers. I'm just going to end up doing that myself anyway. So just go on Google and figure it out if you want to join live. I know it's going to be late for some people, but I tried to do it as early as I could. So hopefully we have the maximum number of people able to join us. And if not, the show's going to be archived on the YouTube channel later on that night. I am going to take the audio from the show and push that out as Sound Off 500 on the feed. So if you listen in Podbean or iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or our Android app or any of those places, you will be able to do that just like you always do. But just be aware, it'll be a little weird because this is a video show. And so there might be things that I'm referring to that you can't see. So it's going to be a little bit different than usual. But I don't think it'll be any less fun. And if you want to get a PayPal donation on that show, I certainly would encourage that. I would love that. But if you want to get your name mentioned, if you want to get a nickname and a shout out on the big 500th show, get those donations in by next Saturday. And you can be part of that. You can be part of Sound Off history. I'm trying to think of what else I wanted to mention here in preparation for the show next week. And I think that's the key stuff. I would just go, and I'm planning on going live right around 8 o'clock. Could be a few minutes after. So, you know, you'll go to the YouTube channel. There should be something up that says either live, that we're already live. If not, just keep refreshing it. And then you'll see where it says live. You click on that. We'll have the chat going. You can participate. I'm going to be taking phone calls. You may have to pay whatever the local or international charges are. It's not a toll-free number. Just be aware of that. But the phone number will be on the screen. And you can call in, and we'll try to get to as many people as we can. And it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it. Maybe I'll have some alcohol on hand. We'll have a good time here. And I'm hoping everything around here goes well too. This is a risk, and it's one of the reasons why I don't do a lot of live shows, is because, you know, I, as much as I wish that this was a soundproof room or I was in an actual studio here, I'm not. And there's a window, and there's a lot of noise that people tend to make outside, and I do my show at a certain time of day when it's usually pretty quiet, not always. So on a Saturday night in the summertime, there could be some partying going on outside. So I don't know what's going to be going on, but we'll roll with it. We'll roll with the punches, and whatever happens, happens. That's what happens when you're live. As Jim Ross once said to Psycho Sid on TV, "We're live, pal." He wanted to redo his promo, but he couldn't. We were live. There's nothing we could do. That's part of what makes it fun. So thank you to everybody who has stuck with me over the years. I've heard from a lot of people who have been listening since episode one, the very first show in November of 2007, and have not missed a show since. And that's just amazing to me, especially with all the wrestling podcasts that are out there, you know, and all the wrestler hosted podcasts, you know, that tend to have an advantage because they were, you know, in the business, in these companies, they have a lot of fun stories to tell, or they're backed by a big network like Podcast One or MLW or something like that. There's a lot of good shows out there. And then you have the, you know, the independent shows. And that's what I've always been and, you know, foresee myself being going forward. And to have been able to build up a base of people who have stuck with me through all of that, and maybe they have 15 podcasts loaded in their feed, and a lot of them say you're still number one. It's pretty cool stuff. So I hope those people are able to be part of the show live next weekend as well, and we can all have a good time. And I, like I said, Money in the Bank predictions, I'll do that on the show as well. People can call in. Maybe we'll talk about the pay-per-view and do a lot of other stuff as well. Otherwise, I'm going to try to follow the same format. You know, I'll talk about Raw and SmackDown and Lucha and any of the big stories during the week. Do some mailbag questions. I'll throw those up on the screen. That is something I would say. I might actually put the questions up on the screen as like a visual as I read them. So if you do email me, again, include your name and where you're from. You don't have to give me your full name if you don't want to. But just be aware that if I do pick your question, it may end up on screen for everybody to see. So check your grammar if you're worried about that. Don't put any incriminating information in there. So we'll be back next weekend, Saturday night, June 17th, 8 Eastern, live on YouTube, Sound Off 500. And that will push out to the feed on Sunday, June 18th, which is Father's Day, Money in the Bank Sunday. Going to be a big weekend next weekend, and I can't wait. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a fantastic week. I will see you for Sound Off 500 live on YouTube next Saturday. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solid Monster sounds off.
This Impact show has moved so many times. It's got more fucking moves than Bruno Mars, this show does. Don't believe me, just watch. Impact started out on Friday, then moved to Saturday, Thursday, then they moved it to Monday. They got slaughtered, so they moved it back to Thursday, then they moved it to Wednesday, Friday again, then back to Wednesday, Tuesday, and now back to Thursday. It's like the Big Show of TV shows. It's turned 1,000 times already, and the only time people pay any attention to it is when it makes them laugh.
Monster sounds off. Since 2007, the Solid Monster sounds off. Available at thesolidmonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solo Monster sound off.